available in more homes than the Pac-12 Network, we are the Podcast of Champions. Fight! I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online.
And here he goes, Miles Jack.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com.
Liner going to try to sneak it ahead. Touchdown, SC!
We are the Podcast of Champions.
Welcome, everybody, back to the Podcast of Champions, the first real postseason edition. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site, on the 247 Sports Network.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com, the USC site, on the 247 Sports Network. And we are the Podcast of Champions. As David said, we're moving into the postseason. We're going to actually have a game preview, a bowl preview, coming up in this episode. But since we talked so much about Herm Edwards last week in Arizona State, we wanted to bring in our buddy, our pal, Chris Cartman, publisher of Sun Devil Source. We're going to talk to him in a few minutes about the out-of-the-box hire of Herm Edwards at Arizona State. If you have any questions for us, we do love to hear from you. Pac-12podcast at gmail.com is our email. You can tweet us at Pac-12podcast, our website where you can find all our old episodes, Pac-12podcast.com. And if you want to call and leave a voicemail, 641-715-3900, extension 734-972. And being the offseason, if you leave a voicemail, it is guaranteed that we're going to play it. And we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about.
I mean, and we may or may not listen to it beforehand.
Right.
So keep that in mind. You know, if it's something, because, like, this isn't a live show. So just keep that in mind. Like, don't say anything vulgar, because then we'll have to re-record, and it's going to be, you know, frustrating for all of us. So just, you know, do us a solid. Yeah, record something nice.
Yeah. If you want to compliment us, that's cool. If you want to make fun of us, that's fine, too.
That's all great. We love that.
Yeah. We're very self-deprecating. We know we have flaws, but we're here anyway. We put ourselves out there every week.
Is someone vacuuming there?
There. So my little office here, they're doing some maintenance apparently outside my suite. So I have it noise proofed as much as possible, but of course they're coming around right around now. So I apologize for that.
No, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. It adds a little flavor to the show. You know, normally it's just that crystal clear audio.
But yes. Now, we're normally in a coffin. Yeah. They were like kind of cleaning and then they went by. I'm like, oh crap. What is going on here?
Oh, so good. I'm excited to talk to Chris. That's going to be fun.
It will be fun. You know, Chris is not going to pull any punches about everything that's going on. Maybe we can talk about a few things first before we bring him on, because I know it's going to be a few minutes. I don't know how much we got to talk about Oregon last week. Was Mario Cristobal, was he hired last week when we talked, or he had not been hired?
No.
Okay,
no,
so there's some news. So
I mean, Willie Taggart, I don't think, had been officially hired at Florida State by that point either.
Really? Okay, so this is breaking news. Willie Taggart, he gone. And Mario Cristobal, he's the head coach.
Yeah. My initial reaction is certainly not as virulent as my reaction to the Herm Edwards hire, but I don't think this is a good hire. I think it's pretty short-sighted. Whenever coaches get hired at big-time programs, seemingly strictly because of recruiting to maintain a class or because the players like him. I don't know what the track record on that is, but I can't imagine it's very good. So I'm intrigued to see how this works out. Hopefully Cristobal is the guy who changes it. I know he's gotten some positive reviews from guys like Bruce Feldman, who should be noted, he was a Miami classmate of Feldman's. Cristobal didn't have an illustrious run at Florida International. Obviously, there are some complications with that job. But I don't think that Oregon needed to stoop to coordinator level. They didn't need to retain a guy from a one season staff. I think they could have searched a little bit longer and it would have been fine.
Yeah, it was a little strange to me. I actually had lunch with Bruce the other day and kind of asked him about it. And, obviously they have a kind of a relationship there. He was one of the ones that was more positive of the national writers out there. And I'd asked him, like, you know, his turnaround. He said his turnaround at FAU, he gives him a lot of credit for that, because it was almost like below just starting at nothing, because they had all these other scholarship restrictions and stuff as well. you know, turned it around, didn't get along with the athletic director. So he felt that was the kind of undoing that was going on there. But he felt that he should get a lot of credit for what he did at FIU. And I agree with you there. I listened to our buddies at the Solid Verbal. They had an emergency podcast. I love emergency podcasts, especially if I'm not doing it.
Right.
Yeah. Me doing one at like 3 a.m. in an airport, like that's not always all that fun. But yeah, listen to that one about, you know, because obviously Dan Rubenstein is an Oregon grad. So he was talking about it. And at the time they recorded it, he wasn't hired, but that was kind of the general thinking. And I don't think he had a big issue with it. And we'll see. Now, we still don't know if Jim Leavitt is staying or going. Is he going with Willie Taggart, or do we not know yet?
I don't think it's certain at this point, but it sounds more than likely that he's going to go. At least that's the rumor mill, because he didn't really get consideration for the head coach job at Oregon. I think he's still wanting to be a head coach at some point again.
Yeah. So we'll see. It might work out well, but the whole early signing day, because we don't know what it's going to do. How much did that affect the entire coaching carousel? And it was a crazy coaching carousel. I don't think it helped the coaching carousel. If anything, it made it a little bit more chaotic. Maybe you get some guys hired that wouldn't have been hired. Recruiting becomes more of a factor. And with Oregon having such a good recruiting class, that's really something they didn't want to get rid of. But when you look back, Willie Taggart was 361 days, I think, he was in Eugene, so not even a full year. Certainly some instability going on at the Oregon Ducks program. They'd like to keep as much, you know, I guess some of that positive momentum. They'd like to keep as much of that as possible. And I guess they felt Cristobal was the best way to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I get the rationale. I just, with history as our guide, I mean, how many of those kinds of hires do you see that have worked out? I mean, it's hard to see it. I don't like it when coaches try to keep, when ADs try to force the new coach to keep coordinators to save a recruiting class. I don't like it when coordinators are promoted to save a recruiting class. I just think it's short-sighted. I think if you get the right coach in there, they'll figure it out recruiting-wise, and maybe you don't end up with as good a class that year as you will, you know, the next following years. But I don't know. It just seems like it doesn't seem like a power move from Oregon. It seems like it's something, you know, whenever you make these kind of decisions out of fear than out of like making an aggressive move, I don't have any numbers in front of me, obviously, and I'm kind of, you know, just talking generally, but I just don't know how often that works out particularly well.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have to see. 247 did a piece, I think it was Steve Whitfong, about the coaching carousel and the top five, or I mean, not the top five, like the top kind of recruiting new head coaches, like who would be, who would be good. And so for the ones that are near guarantees as far as good recruiters went, they put Chip Kelly in there. We got our vacuum back. sorry. Future stars, they put Mario Cristobal. So even, you know, Willie Taggart's in one of the, you know, Willie Taggart was in the, near guarantees as far as him being able to recruit at Florida State. But they had Mario at like a future star. Status quo, nobody from the Pac-12. And then the right guy for their new job. Let's see who they have. They didn't have anyone from the Pac-12. And then a couple with question marks. Two Pac-12 teams made that list. So Oregon State and Arizona State with Herm Edwards. So, Jonathan Smith at Oregon State. And then Edwards. We're going to talk about Edwards here in a few minutes. But they said about him, he certainly would be great in the living room. We assume he'll be great on campus visits too. But that we don't know much. Edwards takes over at a place where Arizona State struggled to win recruiting battles against the upper echelon Pac-12 schools. So you have to win by evaluating. We have no clue if Edwards can evaluate. He spent the last 9 years on a television set. He hasn't coached college football since 1989 at San Jose State. Perhaps labeling this as a question mark is saying it politely. So they weren't very high on Herm Edwards either. And that's what we have to get Chris Cartman's take on it.
Yeah, and so that's an interesting point, and I'm going to bring it back to Oregon for a second, because Oregon hired a guy to re- basically, and I'm sure there were other rationale. I'm sure he killed the interview. I'm sure Cristobal's a nice guy, the whole thing, whatever. They hired him mostly to retain this recruiting class and give him continuity. And for me, that doesn't make sense at Oregon. It makes more sense at a place like ASU or a place like Oregon State if they had been recruiting at like the level Oregon was this year, because at those schools, nailing down a top 15 class at some point is huge. I mean, that's like program changing. For Oregon, Oregon's not going to recruit at a consistent top 15 level, but they are going to recruit at a consistent top 25 level. So doing this to retain a coach, and, you know, not to go back to just, you know, beating on Oregon for hiring Cristobal, which I don't even think is like it's like the third worst hire in the Pac-12 this cycle, which is not bad. But it doesn't seem like a move that Oregon needs to make. It's more of an Oregon State thing or a Washington State thing or an Arizona State thing or an Arizona thing. I think Oregon's a little bit higher of a tier of program. It just doesn't seem like the right move for them.
All right, well, let's bring in our guest today. We haven't had a guest in a while, Dave. So Chris Cartman does a great job. He's the publisher of Sun Devil Source here on the 247 Sports Network. Follow on Twitter at Sun Devil Source. Chris, thanks so much for coming in. I know you're in the airport. I guess there was some basketball game or something going on. I guess it was a big deal. What's going on, bud?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you guys really set the bar pretty low for your first guest in a while. So I don't know, like, how this is going to be perceived, but I will definitely do my best. And, yeah, it's pretty cold and windy here, but I don't think ASU fans mind at all. They'll probably, you know, hang out in the breeze for a while, just basking in the glory of that win over number two Kansas, or formerly number two Kansas, I guess I should say. I was sitting courtside baseline for this game, and I still don't really believe exactly what I saw. And Kansas is not nearly the team that it's been historically under Bill Self, or, you know, before that, obviously. But he called them a very soft team and just kind of trashed his own team. But guys, this is ASU basketball. I mean, this kind of stuff doesn't happen. They're in the top five of the AP top 25 since the photos were in black and white in the media guide. You know, like 1981. I don't know why they were in black and white in 1981, but they were. Maybe that was budget constraints or something. But anyways, I'm getting ready to hop a plane. You guys can hear the overhead stuff. I'll be back in Tempe and covering a top 10 basketball program. Surreal, bizarre, whatever.
So how does it feel that, you know, knowing that ASU is now a basketball school? Like, are you just basking in it? I mean, is this just incredible?
I mean, is it? You know, it's like, I don't even know which direction is north right now. I mean, it's bizarre. I thought this was going to be like a bubble team this year. You know, they have good guard play, and last year they were one of the best teams in the country at not having turnovers, and, you know, they can score it and they're fearless, but, you know, they take bad shots and defensively they're pretty average, but they've scored 90 points in 7 out of their 9 games. Like, they're just like racing past teams. They had 105 against Xavier, which is like, you know, a top 10 borderline type of a team, and hasn't lost other than that. And Kansas hadn't lost back-to-back games when playing the second game at Allen Fieldhouse since 2005, a 37 game streak. So this is very rare air. It's almost like you have to sort of get a hold of yourself to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, it's we don't talk a lot of basketball here on the Podcast of Champions, but, you know, since we had you on, and they just had this crazy win, you know,
ASU is a strong basketball power. We thought we'd talk about it.
Yeah, you know, it's a big win. And
all the sellouts, you know, it's like crazy at Wells Fargo Arena, man.
And there was a funny story with the sports information director there, who I guess he promised his daughter like a $500 shopping spree if they won.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't walk that back when your daughter's got the video. You know, that's the problem in 2017. Like, you used to be able to say, well, I put a qualifier in there. There was a modification of my statement. And now it's like, oh, yeah, I did say that, and you have that. So here's $500. Go have fun. Knock yourself out. I mean, and then today he's wearing a Guard U shirt. Like, you know, I say, we got to have to check your ball skills before you can put on that Guard U shirt. How is ASU Guard U? Like, this thing is so crazy to me. My mind is blown.
All right. Well, we've talked a lot of basketball, and that really hits our quota here on the podcast.
Yeah,
champion.
Okay.
For the year.
Good.
I'm still without words on this, but I know we have to talk about it, even though a lot of ASU fans probably don't at this point. But
where are you going with this, Dave?
Walk me through your initial reaction to hearing that Herm Edwards was not only being seriously considered for the job, but was like the leading and possibly only candidate.
So look, very early on, I was told that Ray Anderson was consulting with people from his past that have a lot of NFL experience. And I'm talking about Tony Dungy and Herm Edwards and some front office people with the Cardinals and other NFL programs. And then within about a few days, like 2 days, it was like, oh, actually Herm Edwards is a candidate. And then within a day of that being reported, we were first to report that Herm Edwards was going to be ASU's next head coach, pending the approval of the university president, Michael Crow, and the Board of Regents, and all of that cross your T's and dot your I's kind of thing. I was pretty surprised. I mean, obviously, the guy hasn't coached in 9 years. He's never been a college head coach. He's 63 years old. Now, Ray Anderson does have this sort of different way of looking at things, and so does Michael Crow. They're like, I almost expect them to turn up in like an episode of Silicon Valley or something. They're just like different kinds of guys, and Ray Anderson does have this tendency to want to surround himself with people that have been in his past, in his career, and he's done so in the senior associate athletic director level. And now Herm Edwards, the guy that he used to represent when he was an NFL head coach, he's the head coach at ASU, guys. that actually happened. So, yeah, it's different. And then they came out with this press release that had the, new leadership model. And it read like some corporate thing as opposed to a typical SID release, which was kind of weird. And then they kept their entire offensive staff in place. And then we reported today that they have an offer out to Phil Bennett, who was hired by Todd Graham to take over the defense last year. So we may even see like almost all the defense stay if Phil Bennett accepts this thing, which is a whole nother layer of like almost unprecedented kind of stuff. Because who in college football, gets a job to be a new head coach at a Power 5 school and then keeps the whole staff in place? That doesn't happen.
Well, that's kind of the point. Like with Ray Anderson's press conference, that was obviously almost everything we're going to talk about is weird. So there's different levels of weird. Ray Anderson's press conference where he talked about keeping the same coordinators, like getting a big name coach or something, but keeping the same coordinators, paraphrasing what he was saying. Everyone was like, how the heck would you do that? Why would you hire someone big, but then have them keep all the same coaches you already had? But in that case, to me, that made it sound like he knew what he wanted. And that's what kind of bugs me about coaching searches is people get in this power and they hire a friend of theirs. Like, you know what? I'm just going to hire this guy. So do you feel like he just had Herm Edwards? That's who he wanted to get from the beginning. So that's why he could say the coordinators are going to stay the same, because I know we're going to bring in somebody who doesn't have a big Rolodex as far as college coaches go anyway.
Well, they did sort of background Chip Kelly. And there was conversation about that internally, and Kevin Sumlin at a lesser level, we reported that, but I think that he did want to hire Herm Edwards, and that was kind of the direction that it was going for a long time. The UCLA loss, in Pasadena that ASU had, was like the final straw. And I had heard even earlier that ASU needed to win 8 wins this season, like get 8 wins in order for Graham to keep his job, which is like a lot.
Yeah.
After the last 2 seasons, and then Anderson comes out and calls 7 wins. You know, he called the Pac-12 weak and riddled, and he said 7 wins isn't that good. I mean, keep in mind, guys, ASU was 6-3 in the Pac-12 this year.
Yeah.
Todd
Graham could have been coach of the year. Like, he probably should have been coach of the year.
He was a legitimate candidate. Yeah. I mean, he's not well-liked by the other coaches, so that's why he was never going to win that. But you know, you can make a great case that he should have been. And other thing is, like, you like the job that he did to bring in these new coordinators, but yet you don't like him or the overall job in some way, which is kind of weird. But yeah, when he said at the press conference, oh, I'd like to keep Billy Napier and I'd like to keep Phil Bennett, everyone in the room was like, really? And then it was like, okay, well then it just makes sense that you're going to hire somebody that hasn't coached in quite a while and has never been a college head coach, because that person doesn't have the connections and resources to staff up, the thing anyways. So yeah, that's where we're at.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around this. Was there friction or some sort of like personal animosity between Anderson and Graham? Was there like something that made it basically untenable for Graham after a certain point? Or was this just, I mean, the most bizarre performance evaluation anyone's ever seen?
Well, certainly they aren't very similar in personality type wise. My understanding is that they really haven't had many conversations at all of any substance in the last year. They met and they spoke after the 2016 season about kind of the direction of the program and how they were headed in the wrong way, and they had a really bad defense and they needed to, you know, take some steps to address that. And that's sort of what precipitated Grant bringing in Phil Bennett. But even after they did that and they started to make these strides, the relationship between Graham and Anderson didn't improve. They weren't really talking that much. I think if you look at it, Graham was very responsible for a lot of the fundraising and other things that allowed the stadium project to take off, brought in some boosters that hadn't really been big supporters of the program in the past. And it's just, that's the other thing to it, is like he is in this new building that they built that's probably about as nice as any building in the Pac-12 outside of Oregon, talking about how he got fired and is like showing such class about it. And then meanwhile, Ray Anderson sort of taking some snipes. He just had another snipe recently. I think it was on the Arizona Republic website where he was said that it's not that it can't be done, more success at ASU, but people haven't tried hard enough in the past. And I'm like, well, yeah. that doesn't make any sense. I'm sure people have tried really hard. Maybe they didn't try as smartly or as creatively as you would have liked or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. And then here's the thing, guys. I'm trying to sum this up the best way possible. So in 40 years, ASU has been to 2 Rose Bowls, okay? The program hasn't been great in any extended period of time under any coach in the 40-year period. I think Ray Anderson felt like, let's try something that was outside of the box. Herm Edwards probably will relate well to, in certain recruiting circles. He's black. He's an older guy. He's got a lot of esteem. He's polished. He's been on TV for 9 years. You can tell recruits, hey, I was a head coach in the NFL for 8 years. I know what it takes to get there. And then I think what they're going to try to do behind the scenes is improve their player personnel, who do we recruit and why and how, then the process for recruiting those players, and then some of the other support areas like, director of creative and video and digital art outreach and some of those things. That's what they're talking about with the new leadership model. Of course, it's not, even if they do a great job, it's not going to be better than some of the best programs around the country. So that's why you have to kind of sell it this way. But it is what it is.
So weird stuff happens, and we talked about it. We kind of just went off on it last week on our show. And, you know it's bizarre. When I get this random email from Michael Samter. He's the executive producer of the Tiki and Tyranny show on CBS Sports Radio. Like, don't know who the guy is. Just get an email about him, I guess, because I was talking about him on Twitter. And, like, there are bullet points about Herm Edwards. And one of them is, did he actually know Arizona State's nickname was the Sun Devils? Because during a press conference, I think it was Devil's Digest or something, they'd asked a question. He's like, Devils. And so he had answered it. He said, are you kidding me? I got recruited from Arizona State. Frank Cush recruited me in the 1970s. Look, I knew Arizona State before half those people. Whatever they were tweeting, they weren't even born when I was getting recruited by Arizona State. So he was saying he knew the Sun Devil thing. But there was other stuff, too, of talking about like being away from 30 years in college. But just like to get this random email from because we're talking about this so much, it's just been kind of weird.
Yeah, that thing went viral. Sports Illustrated tweeted about it and some other outlets. I think Deadspin did. And then it just kind of took off. Herm Edwards is from California. He played at Cal. Okay, so I don't think you play at Cal and you don't know that Arizona State's the Sun Devils, right? Like, that doesn't make any sense objectively. I think he just tried to make a joke. You know, sometimes you're trying kind of hard to get a laugh in that type of a setting. And I think that's primarily what that was. You know, I mean, he shouldn't have done it because it sort of perpetuates something. And Sun Devils doesn't really have anything to do with the devil anyways, quote unquote. For people that aren't aware of that, it actually has to do with an atmospheric condition that causes a thing where there's like a dust devil kind of a thing, but without the dust. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. but he shouldn't. He shouldn't have been doing that, though.
Yeah. Well, and he also, in the video they posted, he didn't know whether he was supposed to wear the little pin forks up or forks down. Like, just, you know, that little stuff.
And the jerseys.
Like,
he didn't know, like,
oh,
the jersey was, like, kind of, like small because they're form-fitting and they stretch. And so he thought it was, like, oh, a girl's jersey.
Well, hating on tech fit is a time honored tradition for me, so I'm fine with that. That was fine by me, but it seems like the general consensus is that Herm Edwards is going to be, you know, kind of that head man, figurehead type deal. But do you see him having any role or influence in the actual schemes on the field, or do you think that just it's going to be mostly on the coordinators?
Probably not that much. You know, he's never been a coordinator himself in college or in the NFL. He went from defensive back coach to assistant head coach to head coach in the NFL. Hasn't been a college coach since 89, I believe. So, you know, he'll have some input, I'm sure, defensively. And I think he's more going to be on the job to recruit and sort of oversee their personnel structure from a coaching and sports staffing standpoint, and then their players and coaches and that sort of thing. There's a lot of jobs. There's a lot of hats that head coaches wear. I don't think he's going to be like, you know, some guy that they just roll around like Weekend at Bernie's or anything, you know. But I think he's going to be busy and he's going to be occupied. But I don't think he's going to be involved as much at a granular level from scheming for opponents, play calling, and those types of things.
So something like this, like both Dave and I are pretty snarky people just in general. And if you know, this was like a softball toss to us. So it's like, they hired Herm Edwards? Like, an agent, like, hired his former, like, all the crazy stuff. We just went off on it last week.
Yeah.
But, and you know, a lot of people do. But if we're talking next, and it's going to be hard to improve next year, I would think. 6-3 in the conference is nothing to sneeze at. Finishing second, they're picked to finish fifth in the conference in the South, and they finish second. But if they're able to repeat that, or win eight games, like was, you know, apparently the Mendoza line for Todd Graham this year, why is this going to work? Like, what's going to go, like, wow, they were really successful. Here's why this worked. Why would you think it would be that this would work?
I think actually next year they could maybe be better because they have I think senior quarterbacks in the Pac-12, it's a big deal when people have a lot of experience. Manny Wilkins will be a senior, and they have nine starters back on offense next year. They'll lose their running backs, but they actually have the best freshman running back maybe in the Pac-12. The best on PFF was Nino Benjamin. And they lose their center, you know, who was a solid player but not great. They basically have five offensive linemen back. They have N'Keal Harry, who will be the best, if not the best, one of the best receivers in the league, and four other really good receivers. I think they'll score a lot of points and be better on offense. So depending on what happens with some of their defensive players, a couple might declare. JoJo Wicker and Christian Sam are at least thinking about it. You know, they probably shouldn't do it for their own prospects, but they should have six guys back on defense. If Phil Bennett stays, they'll have some continuity. So it's not out of the question. They could win eight games next year. Long term, I think it's going to be harder. They're going to have to really, really improve their recruiting operation on the back end, who they're recruiting and how and why they have the ability to get those players to come to ASU, and especially in Southern California, where you guys know it's really hard. Mm-hmm. And now you have UCLA is going to really ramp up under Chip Kelly in that area, I would imagine, and USC's got it rolling pretty good. When ASU's been at its best, it was loaded with California prospects. And we did a 10-year sort of research on all the teams that win 9-plus games and around the country, and all of them except for two get at least two-thirds of their talent from within 600 miles, and those two are Oregon and Nebraska. So ASU has to do a lot better recruiting in Southern California. That's going to be the whole key to whether or not they're able to actually move into a different tier. And it's going to be really hard. Just very, very clearly needs to be stated that what Ray Anderson has put forth as his aspirations or what he thinks should be the case at ASU, which is basically a top 15 program regularly, a top three team in the Pac-12 regularly, that's very unlikely to happen. And not really related to coaches or anything. I looked at all the coaches around the country at the Power 5 level who make less than $3 million. There's 21 of them. None of those programs are averaging more than 7.5 wins as long as those head coaches have been in place. Herm Edwards is going to make $2 million. So the odds that ASU is the outlier of that and somehow averages more than 7.5 wins is just unlikely.
Yeah,
sorry, ASU fans.
No, completely. But that's unlikely for almost any program. I mean, the thing he said about ASU should be a consistent top 15 program. There are two teams in the country that are consistent top 15 programs. That's Alabama, Ohio State, and maybe Georgia, maybe. But USC isn't consistently top 15. That means, year in and year out, getting top 15, and they're the closest thing in the Pac-12. For him to say that, it's bloviating hyperbole and everything, but an athletic director shouldn't be saying stuff like that. You're setting yourself up for just massive, massive failure and disappointment in your fan base.
Well, especially because a year earlier, Ray Anderson came out in the public, he went on the radio, and he said that we want less of this, rhetoric-style talking from Todd Graham. So he actually tried to tamp down Todd Graham with this superlative sort of speech. And then he himself ratcheted it up even more than Todd Graham ever did a year later upon firing him. And David, you're exactly right. Look, you look at 7 years since the Pac-10 expanded to 12 teams, and nobody's been a top 15 team more than four times in those 7 years. Oregon and Stanford have been the best, but to say that you think that's going to happen at ASU is that's disconnected from reality. You need phenomenal proximity to talent, huge operational budget, coaching salaries, facilities, and access to talent all coming together for you to be able to have that happen. And ASU doesn't have that, and it has no relation to who its head coach is ultimately.
I want to talk to you about the recruiting aspect, because I think an important part of any hire is making a program relevant, and I thought Chip Kelly certainly did that. I thought he'd have been a great fit at Arizona State. That's where I projected he was going to go after the season. But I think Herm Edwards does it gives you makes things interesting. I think there's a relevancy factor there. But the people I've talked to, I've had some arguments on Twitter that are saying like he's going to kill it in recruiting. I think when you do go into a living room, I think he's going to relate to the parents very, very well. And that's certainly an important aspect of recruiting. But I think a lot of 16, 17-year-old kids, they're not watching like NFL Live or whatever. Like I would think a lot of them have no idea who Herm Edwards is right now.
Yeah, I asked all of ASU's commitments and some other top recruits that ASU's been on what they know about Herm Edwards. And it's been about a third of them actually know quite a bit. A third of them just kind of generally know who he is, and then a third of them really have no idea who he is. I think he's a very polished and energetic speaker. He's a person that's relatable to families of recruits and recruits in some respects that I think will have some cachet factor. I don't know how much. And I don't know if it's going to be enough in most instances to overcome the typical things that lure kids to certain places like a USC or other nationally prominent programs that ASU is going to be competing with for that talent. And I think that remains to be seen. Whomever ASU had hired probably would have been challenge in those respects, unless it was like a Kevin Sumlin or maybe a Chip Kelly, who have already kind of demonstrated not just the personality type, but also the infrastructure to be able to do those kinds of things. So I'm very curious to see how that kind of works out. He's only had one in-home visit, and it was a running back commit already. He's had a bunch of phone calls with recruits in the last week, and those were pretty well received. I'm interested to see if his style, where he just has so much energy and is so forward, if that works or if that wears on kids or kind of how that kind of unfolds. I think it's difficult to project.
Yeah. Yeah. A very, very, very difficult to project. I mean, not to belabor this any longer, but like how cynical do you think this decision was to fire Todd Graham at this point? Going back to what you said about how next year is going to look, where, you know, that, and I looked at the same thing, where they're returning 9 starters on offense, they've got a senior quarterback. There's a lot of factors there that dictate that in those kinds of seasons, ASU is usually very competitive and potentially wins the South. So do you think Ray Anderson saw the same thing, knew he didn't want to be, you know, tied to Todd Graham for the long-term future, and just decided, you know, basically no matter what result this year, even if it is it beyond something very unrealistic, like 9 wins, he was probably going to fire him?
I think he was going to fire him almost for sure. Going back to ASU getting blown out by Arizona in the Territorial Cup in 2016, the writing was almost on the wall. I think it was a personal lack of confidence.
Right.
I think Ray Anderson just didn't feel like Todd Graham is the guy that I want to roll with in this multi-million-dollar enterprise moving forward. I think it's like a one man board of a company making a decision about its CEO.
Right.
And the vote was basically a non-confidence vote. And we're going to try something different. And the different thing we're going to try is my guy that I have this long-standing relationship and knowledge base about. And I think that he's going to have the X factor, you know, whatever that is, energy and sense and feel for what to do with the program to have it reach heights that it hasn't before.
I never thought I would be sitting here caping up for Todd Graham, but here we are. It's a brave new world. This is just all so bizarre to me. So bizarre.
You know, one of the things that we looked at, what programs like ASU have been able to have pretty good sustained success over a really long time. And it's oddly enough, it was Virginia Tech with Frank Beamer, who had a worse 6-year record in his first 6 years than Todd Graham. And which I found to be, you know, kind of interesting. And it was Iowa, you know, which in its first 6 years wasn't that successful under Friends. So there's something to be said to me about learning as you go on the job and fine-tuning with a better sense of what your market-specific challenges are at a place like ASU, where it's harder to kind of break through in certain areas. And those were kind of my reasons for thinking that Todd Graham, replacing him, probably wasn't the best situation at that, the best decision at that point in time. I thought that he had made some pretty good decisions and they had improved some of their areas that were their biggest flaws and were maybe going to actually be able to keep building off of bottoming it out in that 2015-16 period. You know, but that's not going to happen now. And so we're going to find out if Ray Anderson has this, you know, I've been calling it not an outside the box decision. This is outside the room that the box is in.
I think it's going to be. Okay. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
So we're going to find out if Ray Anderson has some sort of X-ray vision that allows him to see from one room into the other, into that box, to determine this was what ASU should be doing. I'm a little bit skeptical overall, but then again, guys, he hired Bobby Hurley, and ASU basketball is number 5 in the country right now. So maybe this guy just has some sort of sixth sense for this thing that is, like, different, and it could work out. It is absolutely possible, I guess.
Yeah. So it's funny. We're kind of at that stage where you're on Twitter, you're looking at your tweet deck, and someone that you know tweets, ooh, car chase on Channel 9. And so you have to, like, oh, and it involves, like, a nun and a tank and, so, like, something crazy. Like, I got to watch this. I got to turn it on. So we're all going to be watching this because it could be, wow, look at Herm Edwards go, or the most epic failure, like, of all time. It's got to be one of the two, I would guess.
It's a case study. This is like some uncharted thing that you're going to be, like, through the looking glass, you know, trying to see what's going to happen with ASU. I think the whole country is going to be wrapped up attention, you know? And college football analysts, they universally panned this decision.
Yes.
Like, everyone was like, this is bad. This is a mistake. And then you had people that really don't follow college football all that closely who were like, I love this hire. And people on ESPN who know Herm Edwards, this is a great hire. Well, we're also going to find out if the establishment knows what it's talking about or if the establishment actually, like, really doesn't know what it's talking about. And these people that don't even follow it closely and just understand, like, human dynamics are going to end up being right. And I'm, like, fascinated by that, too. So, you know, maybe we'll circle back in a couple years and reexamine our conversation here.
Yeah.
All right, I got one last thing,
okay.
and then I'm done.
But yeah, we'll
what's the fan base reaction to all of this? I mean, I've been underboard a little bit, just because I'm always interested in gauging this sort of thing, and it seems a little bit more mixed than I would have thought. And I'm also wondering, coupled with that, what's the kind of booster, the big money guys, like, what's their take on this hire at this point, as far as you know?
So the booster, the upper crust booster group, which is really about 6 to 8 or 9 guys, they're rolling with Ray Anderson on this. I think a lot of them were on the fence. A few of them were pretty supportive. Most of them actually really like Todd Graham as a person. You know, Todd Graham was great at booster outreach and relationship building and seemed to really love being at ASU and put a lot of his emotional energy into that and the new football facility and the stadium renovation and all that. So, but, you know, almost nobody was, like, really against him and wanted him fired. But then also there wasn't, like, the thing that happened 6 years ago when ASU was going to hire June Jones, where those upper echelon boosters just completely revolted along with the rest of the fan base. Like, that didn't happen here. And as far as the overall fan base, we put up a poll. It had, like, I don't know, 2,300 votes or something like that. And a plurality of people were against this hire. It was, like, 45% against, 35% in favor, and then the rest were kind of uncertain. Now, that's kind of moved in the direction of in favor, but that's primarily because people, they become resigned to their reality, right? Like, what, once Herm Edwards is your coach, what are you going to do about that? You're not going to, like, turn in your fan card or anything.
Right.
Right? So I think now it's now you have people who legitimately are trying to talk themselves into how this could work and why they're going to support it and get on board the train. You know, this is the Herm Edwards train, guys. Get on board or you're not going to have a good seat.
Nice. Well, if you like ASU at all, you need to be following Chris Cartman. He does an amazing job at Sun Devil Swords. Not, you know, just the daily reporting. They cover everything. They're everywhere. But some of the analysis, the analytics he's able to pull through, and he does stuff that I've never even heard of people doing before. So he breaks things down in a way like no one else does. Chris does a great job, and we do appreciate you, Chris, coming on and sharing your insights. We had a field day with it last week, but it was good to get some, you know, an insider perspective of what, you know, actually is going on there.
What did we agree on, Ryan? $2 on Venmo, or was it like $3? I'm gonna definitely get that to you as soon as we're off here for all the praise and the support. And I appreciate you guys having me on.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Thanks, David. See you guys.
All right, see you. Thank you, Chris. Well, that was fun. Chris does, you know, he didn't have to Venmo me any money. I don't have Venmo either. I'm too old, but I'm PayPal, man. I'm dying of PayPal. He does a great job with all this stuff. And some of the analytics, like I said, he does do stuff like, wow, that's really cool that you thought of that and pulled that up somehow.
Yeah, honestly, like, I know some USC fans get subscriptions to, you know, the UCLA site and UCLA site. Some of them get subscriptions to USC sites. So I know all UASU fans are probably on Chris's site already, and you should be, and you should stick there. But Arizona fans, like, if you're, you know, really, you know, interested in you know, the opposing team, the one you're competing against all the time, Chris does a phenomenal job. So you're already, you know, subscribed to Wildcat Authority. Go get an ASU subscription too. It's good stuff.
It does. He does an amazing job there. And yeah, it's kind of, it's like this. We're not gonna be able to turn away. There's part of me that's like rooting for this to be a wild success. And you're just like, wow. And then, you know, obviously part of me that it's just going to be like the worst thing, like the biggest train wreck, like they're calling timeouts in the wrong spot. Like, and plus, any decision he makes is going to be like third guess to the nth degree. Coaches are like that anyway, but any little thing that could possibly go wrong, like, see, that's why you don't hire a guy that hasn't coached in college for 30 years. So it's just going to be so much scrutiny. I think it's going to be just fascinating to watch.
Yeah, I think it could be. Again, I'm still of the opinion it's a horrible hire and it's going to end horribly, and it didn't need to be this way for ASU. So, you know, again, I just this seems like one of those things that, you know, in our present climate where there's so much money involved, it seems even more like just kind of like just pure negligence to make this kind of hire and decision. Especially with like a mid-level Pac-12 program. This isn't Oregon State. Like, you don't need to like, again, think outside the room where the box is located. Like, you can make an in-the-box hire and make a pretty good hire and sustain some success. I mean, or you could just, you know, retain Todd Graham, the perfectly good coach you already had. I don't know. It's not going to make sense to me for a while. Maybe it's going to completely, as Chris said, maybe it'll just be completely great and we have no idea, but it remains extremely baffling to me.
All right. Well, great stuff from Chris Cartman. At Sun Devil Source, if you want to follow them on Twitter, and he does a great job. But we got to have a game we got to talk about, Dave. We got a preview coming up.
A real live football contest between. I mean, should we just get into it? Let's just get into it.
So we have. So this is going to be the team up in Idaho, the Boise State Broncos. They're going to take on our very own Pac-12's
Oregon Ducks.
What's a Bronco noise? It's like something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Okay, fine. Boise State, number 25 in the country, taking on Oregon in the Las Vegas Bowl. This is on a day of horrible bowl games. This is the one good game, so keep this in mind. It's on at 12:30 p.m. in Vegas on ABC. And if you've ever been to the Vegas Bowl in December, that is the only time to play this game. If you try to play this one at night, it will be so cold. I once got low-level frostbite standing in Las Vegas. Oregon is favored by 7.5.
7.5, huh?
7.5 points. So Boise State, let's go by the data we have on their Pac-12 matchup this year. They went to, I believe, overtime with Washington State early on in the season and lost ultimately, I think, 47-44. They haven't played any other Pac-12 teams this year. They did play Fresno State, a team we saw against Washington a couple of times, split, beat them in the conference title game. They played San Diego State, a team we saw a couple of times against ASU and against Stanford, and they beat them by 17. So this is a pretty good and competent Boise State team, but Oregon with Justin Herbert is kind of a different deal to me, and I know they're without Willie Taggart, and that's going to add some tumult to the whole thing, but I think they're going to be playing for Cristobal, who's, you know, he's gotten the interim tag essentially removed already. He's the head coach now. I think they're going to be pumped up to play for him and put on a good showing for him to, you know, so it looks good to have made that hire. And I think they cover this 7.5. I think Justin Herbert looked really, really good in his return, and this offense looks so much better with him than it does with whatever quarterbacks they were trying to run out there, Braxton Burmeister or Taylor Alley, that I think they can put up some numbers on Boise State. And this is a good Boise State team, but it's not the Boise State we've come to know in years past. This is probably one of their, I wouldn't say worst teams, but it's not one of those top-tier level Chris Peterson teams or even the early Brian Harsin teams. They're just okay to me. So I think Oregon takes this, covers the 7.5.
Yeah, I think even, you know, with Willie Taggart leaving, time off, you don't know what's going to happen in the game. Crazy stuff can happen. But I think they're going to rally around their new coach, Mario Cristobal. And I think there's enough continuity there that they'll be fine for this bowl game. And it's not like you have to wait forever. It's a December 16th game, right? So it's coming around here real quick, or we're just days away from it. I think.
Oh, did I even say the day of the game?
I'm
it's
not sure.
Saturday.
Saturday,
December 16th at 12:30 p.m. on ABC.
Nice. David, you know, we haven't previewed a game for a couple weeks, so that's why.
We're rusty.
I just feel like when, like you said, with Herbert, they're a different team. This will be kind of like a springboard into the offseason for the squad. They lose this game. I think it's going to be a rougher offseason. But I just kind of feel like momentum-wise, they're going to do all right. And plus, Boise State got really lucky at the end of the season. Fresno State should have hosted them. You know, Fresno State just beat them. And then, unfortunately, you know, and I used to cover Fresno State, so I like a lot of the people there. They had to go up to Idaho to play the game there instead because of some stupid rule in the Mountain West. But they should have played again at Fresno State, which they did not. And Boise ended up winning a close one there. So I think they kind of got a little bit of karma coming their way that they shouldn't have probably been able to host the Mountain West Championship game. Now they're going to go to Vegas, and I kind of feel Oregon's going to beat them by like 17 or something like that.
Yeah, I could easily see that. I think it'll be a nice little finish to the season for Oregon, which had a lot of frustration midseason when Herbert went down and now is, you know, dealing with losing their coach after not even a full calendar year.
Interesting. All right. Well, so that's that. And then we don't have another game until I think the 26th. There's like 10 days off.
Yeah.
So we'll preview when we do, you know, these shows. We'll preview the games that are kind of coming up for that next week. So that's the only game we're going to preview because it's like it's basically on an island. It's 10 days removed from all the other games. But that might not be bad for Oregon because, you know, just hiring the coach, figuring out, you know, all the other assistants and stuff like that, and give Mario a chance to kind of really hit recruiting and maybe, you know, maybe use a Las Vegas Bowl victory to show him like, hey, I just coached the game. I know I'm the head coach. We just beat Boise State. We're going to keep this going. Taggart's gone, but we're going to keep building on this. So this might be nice to have the early bowl game for them. And, you know, if Cristobal can get a win under his belt, then maybe he can use that for on the recruiting trail.
Yeah, and I think that's 100% right, and I think it gives him a little bit of momentum. Like, there's a lot of good to have this game potentially go big in Oregon's favor, especially, I mean, on the surface. I mean, it's not according to Vegas, but on the surface, beating a ranked team that's got 10 wins this year and you're 7-5 Oregon, I mean, I think that's something you can easily sell as like an immediate thing for people to watch, and then if you win, something to sell that you're going to do a great job there. So, yeah.
So we wanted to talk about the conference awards. The all-conference team was announced, and so the offensive player of the year was Bryce Love. So this happened, I think, on Tuesday, right? So this was like the mm-hmm. day after. Okay. I forget what I talk about half the time. So we, but yeah.
I get it.
No, you know what I'm saying? Like, did I talk about it? I'm doing like other podcasts. So it's like, it's hard to, mm-hmm. not competing podcasts. This is my only Pac-12 podcast, right?
It's your one true love.
Do you
your
do another one?
True love is this podcast.
You don't do any
the
other
podcasts. That's it.
Just bro. Okay. Yeah. No, I meant you don't do another Pac-12 podcast like behind my back or anything, right?
Yeah. It's that other one that no one's ever heard of because there aren't any other podcasts at all. Actually, there's a Podcast of Champions basketball podcast. Have you ever seen this?
No, it's a...
It's like an Arizona-based Pac-12 basketball podcast.
Oh.
And I think they started after us, so we should file a cease and desist.
Yeah, we could definitely do that. I get weird like emails every once in a while, like, hey, I'm on this Pac-12 Facebook group. I'm like, you are? There is one of those? And I'm like, do they talk about us? So if you're on that Pac-12 Facebook group, make sure you tell them, hey,
yeah,
listen to the Podcast of Champions. All right, so we're not going to go over like every position if this was the right guard that should have been second team or whatever, but we'll go over some of the big stuff. So Offensive Player of the Year, Bryce Love, Stanford. Is that cool? You agree with that? Or
I'm fine with that. That completely makes sense. I could have made an argument for Khalil Tate. He was the one reason Arizona wasn't a below 500 team this year, but yeah, Bryce Love's fine.
And then the Defensive Player of the Year, Vita Vey from Washington.
I'm okay with that. That seems fine.
Yeah, there was other like Hercules Mata'afa or Ichenna Nwosu or a couple other names that were mentioned.
Nwosu could have gotten it from me just because I think he affected the game in ways that you don't traditionally see from a linebacker. Like the way he would tip balls at the line of scrimmage, like it's something that like just jumped out to you watching games. It's something that I know the UCLA coaching staff talked about before that game. Like it's just, that was a factor. And Mata'afa I thought was really, really good this year as well. But yeah, I mean, I think that was fine too.
We got, so for the offensive players of the year, co-offensive players, it was JJ Taylor from Arizona. He's a running back. And then Walker Little, lineman for Stanford, and then defensive player of the year, freshman defensive player, Colin Schooler, he's a linebacker for the freshman defensive player of the year, and then which that's fine or whatever. And this one I had the biggest problem with, coach of the year David Shaw. I went on like a Twitter rampage about that.
Yeah.
So I don't get your thoughts too, but I thought that was ridiculous.
Yeah, I thought that was crazy. I think David Shaw did a fine job this year. Like, I don't think it was great. He obviously had to manage a quarterback situation that wasn't great, but it was sort of his own making that it wasn't great. He had to manage Bryce Love's injury, which wasn't great, but, you know, I thought he did a fine job. I don't think it was the best job in the Pac-12. We said earlier we thought it was Todd Graham, but, I mean, I think you can make a case for Justin Wilcox, who I thought did a great job at Cal. I mean, remember preseason, we all thought Cal was going to be like 1-11, and they went 5-7 with a real shot at 7-5. Or even Clay Helton. I mean, I don't think it was a spectacular job, but getting USC to 11-2, I mean, that's not nothing. So I think you can make an argument there. I didn't think Shaw was deserving this year. I thought Stanford was maybe even a little bit... I don't know. I don't know if they were a lot better than their record, but they shouldn't have had as many offensive issues at the beginning of the year as they had because he made a bad quarterback decision.
Yeah, I think he was very stubborn. I mean, if you remember that, and they should have lost the Oregon State game. Like, that was a miracle they won that game. And he didn't even play KJ Costello in that. And he was asked at halftime. It might have been Jill Savage. I forget who was interviewing him, but, like, hey, are you going to see KJ Costello? And he gave this kind of smirk. And you know, if I had to put myself in his head, he was like showing the world, I know you all think we should put this guy in, but I'm going to show you we can win with the other guy. Like, just to be like stubborn about it. And almost lost that game. They lost to a Mountain West school. Like, I get if you want to – most of the time you want to do underachieving or, I mean, overachieving stuff, right? Like, you look at that. Or – like the big winner. Like, it could be either one. Like, LeBron James will win like the MVP once, but then he won't win it for a while because he's the best all the time. If you're going to pick like a division winner, you'd have to pick Clay Helton over David Shaw. Like, he beat him twice, you know, and didn't lose to the, you know, they played some close games, but didn't lose to Western Michigan like Shaw lost to San Diego State. And to have two head-to-head wins, it just didn't make any sense to me. Like, if you're going to pick a division winner, it should have been Clay Helton. If not, if you want to pick, like, you know, you pick the guy that was picked to finish fifth and ended up finishing second, like Todd Graham, or like you said, Wilcox only won a couple of Pac-12 games, so it's a little harder, but I think that's the kind of way you have to go. So just the David Shaw thing made zero sense to me.
Yeah, and then, I mean, a couple other notes from here. ASU only had one first-team selection for both defense and offense, which is crazy to me for the number two team in the Pac-12 South this year. Overall, I think they only had three total first or second team selections on either side of the ball, which is just, I mean, nuts. UCLA's defense had a first team selection, which I thought was crazy. Kenny Young got first team linebacker. Actually, I didn't agree with all. The only UCLA pick I agreed with was Josh Rosen being either first or second team offensive at quarterback. I mean, that was fine. Either Darnold or Rosen, I thought, should have been there. I mean, I think you could have made an argument for Khalil Tate again. He tailed off a little bit at the end, but I thought, you know, it was going to be Darnold or Rosen for both of those spots, and I think it's fine the way it worked out. The one piece that was weird for me, and this is kind of a UCLA-centric point, but I'll make it. Jordan Lasley led the league in receiving yards, in yards per catch, and he only played 8 games this year, and he's nowhere to be found in the first or second team offense.
Interesting.
Which is nuts. I mean, he was the most explosive receiver in the Pac-12 this year. Didn't make the teams, and he was suspended for 3 or 4 games. Which is why he only played 8. So maybe it's, I wasn't aware that, you know, disciplinary actions were a factor in determining who makes first or second team. So that was a little nutty. Anything else jump out to you from this?
Well, I mean, because you talked about Khalil Tate potentially being like offensive player of the year, but you don't seem to have an issue with him being not first or second team quarterback.
Yeah, and I guess that's a good point.
And Luke Falk too. Like, I know he got benched a couple times, but should he have been up there also? I don't know.
Luke Falk should have been like 11th team quarterback for me.
Wow.
He was okay. So bad this year. And I people aren't going to look at those stats and say, oh, he was so bad this year. But that was an air raid offense, and he's out there just throwing picks and not doing anything right for, like, long stretches of several games. He got pulled twice for Tyler Helinski, who isn't good. I mean, it was nuts. I thought he had a horrible year. So, nowhere on it for me. And I guess you're making a good point, which is I just got done saying Khalil Tate could have been the offensive player of the year, but I mean, maybe in my mind, I'm thinking of him as like a playmaker and not necessarily a pure quarterback. And then when I think about the pure quarterbacks, but yeah, hell, let's put Khalil Tate in there. Let's put him in over. Yeah, I probably would have flipped the two. I would have had Rosen first and Khalil Tate second, and then bumped Darnold to third team just because of all those fumbles. But you make a good point, Ryan.
It's hard though because he didn't play the whole year, and it's not his fault. But and then towards the end wasn't setting the world on fire, but he had that like month and a half of just being unstoppable where his numbers were so good it was like he played the whole year.
Yeah it was a tough year. I mean, that's three exceptional quarterbacks, and then if Justin Herbert plays the whole year, he's going to be in that conversation too. So I mean, some pretty good quarterback play in the Pac-12, and then defensively I thought it was mostly fine. Again, I don't think Kenny Young should have been first team, but other than that, I mean, I just think leaving out ASU so much when they were the second best team in the Pac-12 South strikes me as funny and weird.
Yeah.
Especially in light of also Todd Graham not getting coach of the year. You know, it just seems a little funky.
Yeah, some people said that a lot of, you know, well, Chris Carpenter said it too, like earlier, like that Todd Graham's not the most popular guy, so coaches might not vote for him, and yeah, whatever. But
yeah, maybe.
So that's the, we didn't talk about the Heisman Trophy, so Bryce Love finished second. That's the sixth time since 1982 a Stanford player has finished runner-up. No other school has more than twice that it's happened. So is this like a Pac-12 thing? Is it just Larry Scott screwing this up too?
I think it's nuts. I think it's one of those coincidental things, but they should have won at least one of those. I mean, Christian McCaffrey, I think we went through it a couple, maybe last week or the week before, but Christian McCaffrey for sure. And then one of those Andrew Luck years, he should have won. So, yeah, I mean, I think that, Stanford gets a lot of credit under Harbaugh and Shaw for their defense, which has been good a lot. But that offense has produced some really explosive playmakers. And it's a little funky when you think about it because you're always thinking, oh, stolid old Stanford just kind of grinding out four-yard carries. And that's really hasn't been the offense all that often. Yeah, they've had, you know, their Toby Gerhart years and I think whoever that other other running back was. Blanking on his name right now. Who was their guy in 2012? Whatever. But like Toby Gerhart and a couple of the other ones they've had who are a little bit more grinded out, but you've got McCaffrey, you've got Love, and then you've got, you know, exceptional quarterback play from Andrew Luck in the last bunch of years. I mean, those have been some good offenses in Stanford.
So should we, I don't think we have a ton of questions. Should we jump into some questions though?
Yeah. Do you want to read the first one while I pull it up?
Yeah, which, let's see, was it, I think we got, oh, it's okay, so these were the fifth, I think.
Just pick one, and then okay. I'll start where I remember we left.
We'll go to Bruin Brian. Dear Bearded Bruin and Tolerable Trojan, your old pal, Bruin Brian, here again with a few random questions. One, who has been worse for the Pac-12, Larry Scott or Tom Hansen? I think I'm going to go with Hansen because he was just awful. Like, at least Larry Scott came in to do a few things, but he's kind of reverted to Hansen mode. He did a few things early, and then he's just kind of – now he's back to status quo.
Well, the Pac-12 network, for all of its issues, is still better than what we had before, which was occasionally games not being even televised. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's better. I mean, what was it – there was that one channel that games kept being on. Was it Versus?
Yeah, I think Versus.
Yeah, there were a couple of different networks that games would be on that, like, we joke about the Pac-12 network, nobody has it. But some people have it, and you can get it in a few different ways now. There's, like, Sling TV and all that other stuff. But there were, like, networks that these games would be on that literally nobody had. Like, not literally. Yeah, I mean, figuratively. You know how that one got moved. I mean, literally doesn't really mean literally anymore. But that basically nobody had, you know, like... couple million people might have this network. So it's better. It's just not good. And when you compare it to the rest of, you know, all of college football and every other conference, it's really not good. But yeah, he's better than Tom Hansen, who was a complete joke.
And I think Versus used to be something else before it was Versus, maybe. Or I don't know. But then it ended up becoming, that's like the NBC Sports Network now, I think, right? But even like the NCAA basketball tournament, it's some True TV, like games are on that, like whatever that is. But yeah, so I think it's better. But I think that Tom Hansen was just like never change anything. Larry Scott changed a few things, but then he's just been kind of like steady as she goes since then. Two, Dave, why the hell did you leave beautiful SoCal to live in Atlanta?
God, that's a great question. Southern California is very expensive, which played into it. It was also a chance to be closer to my lady friend's family. We're unmarried, which is why I can never like come up with a good way to say who she is. We're unmarried, living in sin with two children. You know how it is. It was just kind of an opportunity to get out of that expensive place to live and get somewhat closer to her family. So that's the real reason.
We're working on trying to get them back here, guys. So So you can Venmo him some extra cash, and then he'll
just Venmo me money, lots of it, and I will move back. That's it. That's all.
Number three, UCLA has lost a lot of commitments since CK, I think he's referring to Chip Kelly, came aboard. Are you, like, little side note, I'm really not big in the whole, like,
I hate it.
Abbreviation of coaches.
I hate it so much.
And like CCK, Coach Chip Kelly. I'm just like, I did.
CCK, I keep like stuttering over it in my mind and thinking CPK. And then I'm like, wait, that's weird. And there have been some weird ones that have come out over the years, too, where it's just like, I don't think that spells what you like. Coach Urban Meyer. Like, think about that one for a second.
Yeah.
Take a second. Think about it. Like, you just don't want that. And then you're in this position where it's just like, well, is it just UM then?
Yeah.
Is it just
If it's like a unique name, like, just say Urban, you know, like, you know, if you say Urban, you know what you're talking about. Chip.
Yeah, just Chip. I know we like to save characters in this day and age, but just say a person's name. Come on. We don't need to do this.
Yeah.
Say their last name. That's what we in journalism do. It's fine.
But
just
if it's like, Chip.
It's like three more keystrokes. Just do it. It's fine.
All right. So that's a little tangent. Seems like more than I would have expected. He was talking about the loss of commitment. Decommitments, as we like to call it in the industry. Can you discuss why so many have left, and if you think the class may ultimately end up stronger than it would have been if JM had stayed?
All right, I'll start first. Number one, I don't care. Like, I just when you hire a new coach, some weird things happen in recruiting. Sometimes it ends up bad, sometimes it ends up good. It doesn't matter. If you hire the right coach, it won't matter. Second, I think some of these guys are guys who are obviously dropped, and I'm not going to name names, but when a new coach comes in, he's often going to see guys who are coming in who he's like, nah, I don't want to get that guy. Some of the guys who decommitted were out-of-state guys who were tenuous at best to remain committed anyway, and saw this as a really convenient opportunity to say, nah, we're not coming out west. And then there were some guys who I think legitimately had developed relationships with, you know, Demetrius Martin or other coaches who were on staff who are no longer and have, you know, backed off their commitments in a big way. I don't think, you know, it's end of the day for any of those guys at this point. Usually when you're decommitting pretty late, especially after a coaching change, if you're actually doing the full decommitment, it's, you know, reasonably unlikely that you're going to return to the fold. But, you know, I don't think it matters all that much. I think he's going to end up with a pretty good class. He's putting in a lot of work recruiting. You know, Chip Kelly had a little bit of a knock, actually, as, you know, not the most energetic recruiters, but he's drawing great reviews so far, has been, you know, on the phones, burning up the phones, and I think he's, you know, heading out on visits and all that kind of stuff. So I think they're going to end up with a reasonably good class, but usually the effect of a coaching change, or at least this is historically true, and I think it's going to be even more true now that there's the early signing period, the effect is generally felt the following year. So when Jim Mora was hired, that was a great recruiting staff that he initially had at UCLA. The 2012 class was good, but then that 2013 class was top five. And I think if Chip Kelly has the season that, you know, UCLA is certainly paying for, and puts it together in a big way, I think that's the class where you're really going to start to see a big effect from this hire, that 2019 class. So that's what I would just keep in mind, is that these things, you know, unless the hire is made like right after the season, and it's, you know, like USC closed with a great class, I think, when Sark was first hired. But generally, most schools, it's that year following that, because it takes a while to build relationships.
Certainly. Number four, he says, serious question. So apparently the other three were not serious questions. Are the folks in charge at ASU stupid, playing favorites, somehow paid off by someone, or just plain lazy with the hiring of Herm Edwards? I think we discussed that pretty well with Chris Carman.
Yeah, we've hit that one, Bruin Brian.
Yeah. And then five, Trojan. So it's me. Do the people in charge at $UC think Clay Helton is a good coach? Are they nervous, as they should be, about the hiring of Chip at UCLA? The people in charge, I think, like him. Lynn Swann, after the Pac-12 championship game, gave him like his full support. I think Lynn Swann was even critical after the Rose Bowl saying that, you know, they didn't win the Pac-12 and that's what the goal is. So I think he's pretty happy with that, at least from what he was saying. He was going to take a standoff, you know, like a just a stand back and watch approach, like let him do his job. He's not going to force him to make some assistant coaches and stuff. I think, I don't know, I haven't talked to anyone at USC that's like nervous about the hiring of Chip Kelly, but it certainly has got people's attention. And I think it will force USC to make some changes. They do need to clean up the staff a little bit, make a few moves. They might have one already happening. It looks like his brother, Tyson Helton, was going to take the job as offensive coordinator at Tennessee. We haven't heard that 100% sure yet, but that's what everyone was reporting. And like Dave said, if Bruce Feldman reported it, then it's happening. He reported that. So we'll find, they're going to start practice tomorrow. So I'll go down there and find out like if he's sticking around, if he's already left for Tennessee. We just have no idea at this point. So I wouldn't say nervous, but I certainly think it's going to impact some of the decisions they make in this offseason.
Yeah.
And he said, I hope Ohio State stomps the crap out of Suck in the Cotton Bowl and go Bruins. Kind regards, Bruin Brian. I wouldn't think he's like our target audience. Like if you're not a Pac-12 fan, like if you just would, you know, if you're always going to root for the Pac-12 teams, those are the people I think would listen to us. But he is certainly not rooting for, I think he meant USC. It's mixed up.
You know what? You know, I'm interested in this actually. Fans out there, we'd love to hear from you on this point, because Ryan's contention is that, you know, it's always good to root for the other teams in the league. I'm a little bit more wishy-washy on it. I think there are some circumstances where it's good, but like there's some circumstances where it's, you know, certainly not so good. So I'm interested to hear where people stand on this. Do you always root for the Pac-12 in bowl games? Do you always root for the Pac-12 in non-conference games? Or what have you? Because I know there's a lot of UCLA fans who obviously hate USC, but also hate Cal. like really hate Cal for some reason. Like I don't get that one, but they really, really hate Cal, hate Oregon, who hate Stanford. Like I've known a lot of these people, so I'm interested to hear what the general Pac-12 fan base consensus is on all of this, because I think there are a lot of people out there who are actually, you know, pretty locked in on rooting against a lot of Pac-12 teams that are not their own.
And if it's just the rival, like if you're a UCLA person, you always hate USC, or if you're Oregon State, you could never root for the Ducks, or if it's like just general. And, you know, if you're a UCLA fan and you think Chip Kelly's going to take you to the promised land, it's going to be easier to get to the promised land if USC's better and then you beat them and it makes you look better. You know, it's obviously that kind of stuff makes sense. But yeah, tweet us or tell us what you think.
Yeah, or just email us, whatever.
Yeah,
email. All right, we got what? Pac-12 All-League results from Scott.
Okay. Ready? All right.
Hey, guys. Been listening since day one of the POC and still love tuning in, especially since it's one of the few ways to get my Pac-12 fixed now that I'm living on the East Coast. Here's a question. How does Kenny Young, who couldn't properly fill a hole or make a tackle within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage, get first-team All-Pac-12, while Jordan Lasley, who led the league in receiving despite missing 3 games, was actually 4, resulting in about 160 yards per game average, get honorable mention? UCLA had one of the worst defenses in the nation, yet the MLB gets first-team? The mind boggles. Who exactly decides which players get selected for these teams? I don't even know why I'm mad. This falls right in line with the Pac-12's buttness in across all facets of league operations this year. Cheers or whatever, Scott in New England. So Scott read my mind, or I read Scott's, but yeah, I think both of those were weird. As for who decides this stuff, I know it's, you know, they say the coaches do. I would guess that a lot of SIDs are actually getting tasked with this job, and I imagine a lot of them are just looking at stat sheets. That would be my guess as to what's going on. Now, that doesn't explain why Jordan Lasley didn't get first or second team All-Pac-12 when he led the team and led the led the conference in receiving. But I don't think it's guys making a lot of really informed decisions.
Yeah, I mean, imagine like you have a regular job and then someone asks you to do this task that you really don't want to do. And you got to vote on things and, you know, which offensive tackle is the, you know, honorable. It's like, yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that. So they probably don't, you know, your team better than the people that were voting know your team. So if you can make that argument, and I don't think it's not like they're in a room and discussing it, so they could, someone can point that out. If they were in a room discussing it, all the coaches together, someone would have said, hey, Jordan Lasley led the league, and they're like, oh, okay, we should put him up there. But no one's doing that, so you're just voting and you're overlooking people that you probably shouldn't be. So I wouldn't say it's a conspiracy, Scott, but it's not a – I would trust like the AP ones more, but even those, there's weird stuff that get through there. You're like, how did that guy make it? So I don't know.
Right.
Okay, that's for Scott in New England. Thank you. Tiffany. I'm sorry. This is
That's just an email. That's just an email.
That's just a regular email. Okay. This is from Ryan, Podcast Deep Thoughts. Okay, this is a little long. Thanks for the good work you both put into the Pac-12 podcast, and Dave for the bro work as well, even though you forget to take your Prozac at times. Fair. I enjoy the honesty about the UCLA football program. Brutal honesty, I would say. I share your schoolgirl excitement about the dawn of the Chip Kelly era. This guy knows you well.
He does. Wow.
Is he your former therapist or something? Or is this?
Maybe he should be. He clearly has insight.
I wanted to respond to a couple of points you raised in your last podcast. First, about the Pac-12 officiating. I am personal friends with a WAC/Mountain West football official whom happens to be my tax guy as well.
Definitely should be who there.
Well, he put whom. I was just...
I know. We'll put a sick in parentheses there.
Whom sick happens to be my tax guy as well. So this is a Mountain West WAC official. I thought the Mountain West shared officials with the Big 12, but okay. He and I have had several conversations about the quality or lack thereof of the Pac-12 officials. He said the Pac-12 conference has prioritized more diversity, and he put in parentheses skin color, of their officials over the on-field performance for a long time. He claims this is well known throughout the college football officiating circles, and it's not going to change anytime soon without a challenge at the top, paging Larry Scott. Interesting. So there's like there's an Asian head official, right?
Yeah.
Which you don't see a lot of those.
I
wouldn't say it's across racial lines. I think it's just all bad.
I think they're all bad. I mean, the worst Pac-12 ref we can all remember is our good friend Glasses.
Right. He's a white dude.
So I don't know. I think it's, I don't think it has anything to do with that. I think it's all just the training, the reviews, the competence level of the people hiring and reviewing. I think it's just, it's a systemic issue that I don't think has anything to do with, you know, making whatever diversity hires.
Yeah. Okay. He said, second, I really enjoyed your conversation about the theory of another suck leaving the Pac-12 to become independent to reap more TV revenue and wake up the conference brass who is obviously asleep at the wheel. I wanted to share a modern day case study with you guys that you could debate on a future podcast. BYU became independent in 2011. At the same time, signed an 8-year deal with ESPN, making their annual TV revenue. So it went from 1.5 million. I'm sorry, what was that?
I was just doing it, but you can do it.
Okay, yeah. So it went up. I think he's missing a word there. Went up from 1.5 million to over 5 million. Results since versus the Mountain West champion, strength of schedule. Let's see. It said 2011, 10-3. And then in parentheses, 66. That's their strength of schedule. Mountain West champion TCU was 11-2. They had a 43rd ranked schedule. In 2012, they were 8-5, 36th ranked schedule. Boise State was 11-2, 75th ranked schedule. 2013, they were also 8-5. Their schedule keeps going up, 28th. The Mountain West champion Fresno State, 11-2. Their schedule is going down, 77th. 2014, 8-5 again, 58th ranked schedule. Mountain West champion Boise State, 12-2, 64th.
Let's just abbreviate this. Every year, BYU's strength of schedule is better than the Mountain West until this past year when they were 82nd and Boise State was 67th.
Gotcha. Okay. That's the kind of point he was making there. He said, I would argue BYU had to play a much tougher schedule being independent and lost a significant amount of national recognition not being a conference champion. However, gained $3.5 million annually in TV revenue and still went to mediocre bowl games along the way, collecting an average bowl payout of $612,000 per year. Good move for USC still. Thoughts? Thanks, guys. Go Bruins. Ryan G. from Yorba Linda.
What do you think?
Someone tweeted me the first of all, it's a really hard comparison with BYU. It's certainly a different sort of thing. Someone wrote, I think an SB Nation guy wrote a story based on like one of my tweets. I'm actually going to be on John Wilner's podcast this week. Our buddy John, who you know does a great job covering the Pac-12. He does a Pac-12 podcast just kind of infrequently. He doesn't do it all the time. And he gave us high praise, Dave, by the way. He was like, he aspires to be like us. So even though I told him, we quote him a lot in our stuff. But
I think that's a solid goal for anyone out there.
Yeah. They should be like us.
More like us. Yeah, anyway, less like other people.
So he thought it was fascinating. So he had me come on the podcast and talk about it. And I'd said, like, USC, the brass at USC is not even thinking about this. Like, it would take someone, like, maybe Lynn Swann has it in the back of his head, but everyone that was there before, no one was ever thinking that way. So I don't ever think that something's going to happen. But I feel like if it was at least discussed and explored, then maybe it would force the Pac-12 to kind of change a little bit. And the whole, you know, Larry Scott's focused on parity, which is fine. It's probably better for all the schools involved. But if you want your conference to be relevant, I don't think you focus on parity. I think you have to kind of clear a path for the schools, whoever is at the top. Don't impede them from making the playoff. And you could argue this year, if USC didn't have to play Washington State on Friday night and had a bye week somewhere, that they're in the playoff. So that just the Pac-12 schedule alone could have kept USC out of the playoff this year.
Yeah. I mean, again, yeah, sure. As a specific example, maybe, but again, USC was not.
No, I don't think they're playoff worthy, but
yeah.
Is Alabama? Like, who's Alabama beat this year?
All right, well, let's just go by S&P Plus, which is an advanced stat ranking, because I want to make this point to people. Alabama didn't win their conference, right? But this is a study of dominance, essentially, as the S&P Plus. It basically is tracking play-by-play, how dominant are you? You know, drive-by-drive, how dominant are you? Alabama was the number two team in the country, according to advanced stats. USC was 22nd. So the teams that made the playoff were what? Alabama, Georgia, Clemson, and who was the other one?
I'm sorry, so you're talking about playoff teams?
Yeah, who's the other playoff team? Oh, Oklahoma.
Yeah, I was going to say, what? Oh.
Those are all top eight teams in, you know, according to advanced stats, whereas USC's, you know, 22nd. And that wouldn't have changed drastically if they beat Washington State by three or lost by three.
But if they, you know, if they had a bye week, they might have beat teams, you know, I think Clay Helton's mentality going into the season, right or wrong, was conserving energy and not going all out all the time. And because of the
How would a bye week have kept them from being facing whatever it was, a 4th-and-1 against Texas, where if Texas punches it in, they win instead of going to overtime?
I mean, I think it changed their practice schedule. Like, I don't agree with what they did, but I think that was something that was on his mind all year. And I think it impacted the team all year.
Well, I get that, but like, I don't know. The same team that, you know, was in it, you know, struggling against whatever directional Michigan team they were playing at the beginning of the year, where they were tied in the fourth quarter, where they, you know, nearly lost to a Texas team that ended up 7-5, where they were tied with Cal at halftime or whatever. I just don't. I mean, I get the point where if they had beaten Washington State, they probably, you know, would have made the playoff, but it would have been a very undeserving team in the playoff.
Right.
Like, they wouldn't have been a particularly dominant or great USC team in the playoff. And I don't think getting killed by whatever it would have ended up being, Georgia or Clemson or Alabama, I just don't think that necessarily does any favors to the Pac-12 either. You know, especially a year after Washington looked semi-competitive against Alabama, but only because they were playing like really, really well. And otherwise, that was pretty much a blowout as well. I just don't think it would have done a real service to the Pac-12.
I mean, but, you know, the SEC has two teams in there, two teams that haven't even played each other this year. So you're talking about USC and Ohio State. They had to play 10 conference games. Alabama only played 8. You're at least giving your teams a chance. And I think if you could argue that if the SEC did something to their schedule that made it so Alabama couldn't make the playoff, that would be a huge problem. USC and Stanford, that's like Alabama and Auburn playing in week 2. All that stuff I don't think makes sense. So that's all reasons why I think, yes, I don't think any Pac-12 team deserved to be in the playoff, but you could have made it and been in there and get the bigger payday and have a chance to win the national championship. You know, I mean, that's, you don't want to like hold yourself out of that. If a team goes and, you know, Washington went last year and didn't look all that competitive, fine, whatever. But you don't want to like hold yourselves back, like sanction yourself from going to the playoff. And I think that's what the Pac-12 does.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I get the point. I get the point. Where I get tripped up is when we start applying it specifically to this season. I think it makes sense as like as a general point, which is, yeah, the Pac-12 should assess at the beginning, like when they're setting schedules for the next year. All right. Who's our like top four-ish teams? Because you never know, you know, specifically who's going to be super dominant, but who's our top four teams? Let's make sure they don't have anything insane in front of them. Not necessarily let's set it up in favor of them, but let's make sure it's not stupid. Like, I think Washington had a lot of stupid stuff this year. I think they had maybe even a more egregious claim than USC. And, again, according to advanced stats, Washington was a much better team. But this is – I think they set things up poorly for teams that are going to be good, but I don't think necessarily that any team in this league was good enough to make the playoff this year. I think it's like a – It's not a weird time to make the argument, but it's not like a perfectly fitting time because anybody like me just now can come back with, well, any Pac-12 team in the playoff would have gotten killed anyway.
I mean, I think the one thing you could argue, though, too, is like they put roadblocks in front of all the top four teams. Like, you know, Washington State, what did they have to play? They played Cal on a Friday after a road game. Then they had, you know, and they would have had, if they'd made the championship game, they would have played at Seattle and then come down to Santa Clara on a Friday night. Stanford went to frickin' Australia, played the favorite in the Pac-12 in week two, and then had, you know, they end up losing. You know, so if they're not doing that, maybe Stanford doesn't lose to San Diego State, and they're a little bit better. And yeah, you make everybody a little bit better. And, you know, Washington losing, they had to go a Friday night to play Stanford. Washington and Stanford on a Friday night, like, are you freaking kidding me? And that's what they had to do. So it's like, roadblocks were in front of all the power teams. They all end up losing, and it makes those games at the end less important. So I think you're hurting the overall upper-end brand. Don't do that. Let teams are going to screw up anyway. Don't put roadblocks in front of them and help them screw up.
Well, and I would also say they put roadblocks in front of a lot of the crappy teams too. I mean, Cal and UCLA both had Friday night road games as well that were just – I mean, and Cal was playing a Friday night road game on 6 days rest, same as everybody else at the end of the year. It's more just I we're talking about it in particular, but it's more just this is a systemic issue with the entire conference, which is they're run by idiots who don't get football and don't understand the sport. And so the schedule was extremely stupid this year. It's, you know, mildly competent next year, but it was a bad, horrible schedule this year. And it affected, I think the more noticeable one is it affected the teams that, you know, had a chance, but it affected everybody.
Yeah.
Nobody won a Friday night road game in this conference. So I just, you know, it's screwed up. So it's getting fixed next year to at least a certain extent. But, yeah, I mean, I get your point. Like, I completely get it. It's just I don't know if this year it would have necessarily, you know, if USC doesn't lose that game, they're in the playoff, but they might be getting killed versus – you know, and they might get killed against Ohio State. But I just, you know, I think this is maybe a better result for that program. Maybe not for the Pac-12 as a whole, but maybe better for the USC program.
Yeah. All right. You want to go? Your buddy's next, I think.
Okay. All right. Let's do this. Hithloday Almond. Oh, you know what? We were supposed to do a segment on his last question in this episode, but we have the planning ability of a pair of morons. We'll get to it next week. Get to it next week. All right, this is Dog Whistles from Hithloday Almond. I'm happy to learn I've inspired a new segment breaking down structural aspects of programs. I look forward to hearing it, and of course the fat royalty checks. Once we actually record it, maybe. Three issues come up repeatedly on the podcast. One, the Pac-12 has many silly policies in terms of scheduling, kickoff times, and officiating. Two, the champion has now been left out of the playoffs twice. And three, the conference should be making more money. Your listeners repeatedly write in to suggest these things are connected, but I get the sense you, Dave, and Ryan don't actually believe they are. 2 years ago, I asked about Stanford getting left out because they lost to Northwestern and Oregon, and you replied that you would that they would have played those teams even with an 8-game conference schedule, and that the trees were left out because they just weren't that good. Earlier this year, I asked you if more revenue actually means anything for schools like USC and Stanford, which already have sufficient resources to meet their program goals, and you said, nope, it's just a dick measuring contest for them, and additional revenue is only significant to a school like Wazoo. This year, you've both repeatedly stated that you don't think USC is one of the four best teams in the country, but that they'd have snuck into the playoffs if the poor Trojans had just one more day of rest before facing the mighty 33,000 in Pullman. I'm not sure if Wazoo is the hero or villain in the narrative here, but Ryan's heel turn with wanting USC to ditch the deadweight schools is at least amusing. So, what am I to think on connecting these things? Do you seriously believe it would be great for the Pac-12 if its undeserving champions, through some presto change to conference policies, defraud their way into the playoffs and get killed by better teams in order to have a playoff distribution check sent to all that have-not programs who, in gratitude, would agree to stop upsetting their betters and donate another waterfall to Heritage Hall, hire referees with the wisdom of Solomon, and construct a broadcast tower so powerful it forcibly blasts the Pac-12 network into the bridgework of East Coast fans? And that this sweet but unearned manna from heaven would at long last make all the teams your listeners root for stop sucking at football? And if you don't believe this nonsense, aren't you dog-whistling your listeners by implying that it's the conference that's screwing them instead of the reality that they have serious competitive problems of their own making because they hire shitty coaches and have fickle fans? Wow, that was poetry.
That was
gorgeous.
You have to have a name like Hithloday to write that, I would say.
That was beautiful. Well, that's a pseudonym. I don't know what, or a nom de plume, if we will. Wow. There was a lot to digest here. I wish I'd read this one before I read it out loud. I don't know. I where I stand on this is sort of like a middle ground where, yeah, the Pac-12 does screw some things up. Big time in a lot of ways, but I also, like the point I just made when we were talking about the last thing, wow, this really dovetails nicely, actually. The point I just made is that I don't think anybody in the conference was good enough to win a playoff game this year, so maybe it's simply that, you know, here's a question. Does USC having Clay Helton put them at a competitive disadvantage with being a potential playoff team? Like, if they'd had, you know, prime Pete Carroll this year, are they a playoff team?
Probably.
If they'd made an elite hire instead of hiring a coordinator in 2000, the November of 2015, do they actually make the playoff this year?
I mean, obviously that's hard to say, but I think you could argue that. Just like you could say, hey, if the schedule was better and not, you know, if there was a bye week and not Friday night road games after a road game, you could argue they'd make the playoff too. So, I mean, it's hard to really say. But you would think, like, it was the margin was that thin that, yeah, that probably would have happened. If you had a better coach, you'd maybe have a couple better players, who knows, and, you know, from recruiting and all that stuff. Not that he recruited bad, but, yeah, you could make that argument.
Well, I would connect it closer to being competitive in the playoff, because I think if you have a better coach, I wouldn't be sitting here saying, you know, oh, well, USC might make it, but then they're going to get killed. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
If they had Pete Carroll, or if they'd hired Chip Kelly in 2015, or if they'd hired Chris Peterson at some point, like, I would then say, oh, well, yeah, USC has a real chance and they're, you know, potentially gonna win it. So, I mean, it's a really interesting point. I mean, where do you stand on all of this?
Well, so I would say this is not like a great year either. Like, all the teams are flawed. And if you have a team that is as much talent as USC, sure, they could get killed, but if they beat like Ohio State, they could have won a playoff game, you know? So I think that, like, just to say automatically they don't deserve it is hard. But, you know, you just don't know. I don't think any team is like amazing out there. We've seen all these teams kind of play poorly. You know, Clemson looks really, really good. And they lost to a horrible Syracuse team on a Friday night, by the way, on the road.
By 3 points.
I would say, as far as the revenue stuff goes, I don't ever remember saying it doesn't matter for the bigger teams. I think the problem is not just the daily budget. You're like, okay, you have money. You have plenty of money. And I think Larry Scott's like, we've never had the most money. Well, the problem is that the gap is just going to get wider and wider. And the Pac-12 is stuck in this terrible TV contract. We had Fox and ESPN that came together. So it was like Republicans and Democrats like agreeing on something. Like, something's weird about that. Like, they have to both be getting over on the party that they agreed with, and they are. It's a great deal for Fox and ESPN. It's not a great deal for the Pac-12. That gap is going to get wider and wider, and I think it's going to hurt probably the lower teams even more, because if you're, you know, if you're talking like Rutgers and Washington State or something, do you want Rutgers, who's pretty terrible at football, making like $100 million more over like a five-year period than Washington State? Like, that's, you know, program-changing money. And I think there was a boom in the beginning, and we saw a lot of, you know, coaches got hired and all that kind of stuff and some facility upgrades. But everyone else is going to be making a lot more money going forward. Like, you can't just sit on your laurels. I think that's a big part of the problem. And it's not about USC leaving behind Oregon State to the world or Washington. It's not really about that. It's about they're just a program that could, you know, in my, you know, my theory is could survive on their own. And if you can make more money doing it and not have to deal with a lot of the problems in the Pac-12, there's a reason you should at least consider it. And if you at least look at it and force some change in the Pac-12, it makes it better for everyone else. That's just what I've said.
Yeah, I mean, I get all that. I mean, like, I'm looking at it from like the UC perspective too, because a couple of these teams are UCs. Like, there are stipulations in like how much you can even pay coaches from the UC regions. Like, it's not like this is like the arms race of money. Like, there's only so many different places you can put it. Like, Rutgers with $100 million is still Rutgers. I mean, it's not like it's suddenly going to become Ohio State because it has $100 million. It's never going to be Ohio State. They're never going to be able to coaching salaries aren't ever, especially at, like, state universities, especially at public universities, they're never going to be, like, $20 million a year. Like, that's just not where this arms race, I don't think, is going. I mean, it's taken it's taken like 15 years to get from like the max coach being paid like $2 million a year to now like 7.5 or whatever Jimbo Fisher just got. And it's just hard to see it ever getting into the point where it's like a literal arms race in terms of paying for coaches. And then if it's not that, what are you putting that money into? So all these Pac-12 teams have already invested in facilities for the most part. I mean, I think there's a couple of them who still haven't done it. But for the most part, I mean, ASU got a brand new facility. USC got one in the last 10 years. UCLA got one last year. I mean, they've all gotten brand new facilities. They're all paying their coaches pretty well, except for ASU, which decided to torpedo their program for no apparent reason. But, I mean, you look at all that, and I'm wondering where all that money will go. Because I think it goes to the university at large. In a lot of, especially a lot of the public universities, I think there are hard limits to how much the state is willing to approve them paying a football coach. And I get in theory you don't want to lose that money arms race, but I'm failing to connect where, what point at which it's just, this is just a to Hithloday's point, just a kind of a dick measuring contest where it doesn't, you know. If Rutgers gets $100 million and the Pac-12 team over here gets $50 million, well, what is that extra $50 million getting them?
Yeah, I wouldn't say
to the university at large, or is it to the actual athletic program?
No, I think it's the athletic program. And I think once you start to see, and we've seen one university president at Washington State start to talk about this, where they lost Bill Moos, athletic director to Nebraska. But it's, you know, I think you'll lose some of your best talent that you're not going to be able to play or pay as much to. And I think really the unseen kind of expenses of having those support staffs that do so much work on the recruiting front and social media. And we're seeing the Alabamas and Clemsons of the world investing a lot of money in that kind of
stuff.
Yeah,
but how much are you paying them? You're not paying them $50 million. I mean, so Alabama's got its crazy support staff of like 30 dudes, right? It's something crazy like that, but they're not paying them each like $1 million a year. I mean, a lot of those guys are like not GAs, but they're dudes making like maybe, you know, 40 or 50 grand a year. I mean, that's doable under pretty much any one of these Pac-12 teams budgets right now. They just don't do it. And I think that speaks to, you know, maybe the competitive problems of hiring and, you know, running an organization. I know Chip Kelly, a little bit of info about him, he doesn't like having a huge staff of support people. He thinks it's too many voices in a room and that sort of thing. So it can also be a preference thing. Okay. But you were finishing your point.
No. I'm not an expert on the expenses and how the budgets are run from athletic departments. But if you're Washington State and you're competing with other schools at similar levels in the Big 12 or the Big 10 or the SEC, and you know there's a $20 million revenue gap in television every year, year after year, and that just keeps going on and on, I would think that's going to have a major toll.
Yeah, I guess I'm just failing to connect it. I think a lot of schools, still a lot of like coaching salary decisions are, especially at the bigger schools, a lot of it's just still booster driven because it's guys who want influence in the program. And then you've got the TV money, but I think I just don't know how much of that is like getting reinvested specifically into football. And I mean, I get the point, but I'm struggling to connect when it gets into the astronomical figures. Like when we're starting to talk about, you know, $100 million for Rutgers over the course of 5 years or whatever it is versus $40 or $50 million for the University of Washington, it's just like, well, okay. I mean, it's still a lot of money that they really weren't getting before. And it's not like coaching salaries have risen, you know, so astronomically to make up for that. I mean, we're not too far removed from when the, you know, these TV contracts were minuscule comparatively. And it's not like the coaching salaries have risen in that same, you know, kind of ratio. It's, you know, I think, you know, the TV boom certainly happened, but it's also going to, you know, that bubble is also probably going to burst. And I don't think we're going to be looking at, you know, these kinds of huge revenue gaps, even like 10 years in the future, because, you know, people are cutting the cord in rapid numbers and ESPN's going to have to reevaluate every single one of these contracts very soon. So I don't know. It seems like I think intuitively to everybody, it makes sense. Oh, wow. There's this huge revenue gap. But what does it actually mean in terms of actual on-field stuff? And that's where I'm just, and maybe there is a really good answer. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. All right. Well, good hit the day. Good stuff from him. I like that.
Yeah.
Next up, let's see. We got Anthony. Hey, Ryan and Dave, what are your thoughts on the new coaching salaries of Pac-12 and the SEC? For the Pac-12.
Every one of these guys wants to talk about money, Ryan. Yeah. Everyone.
Chip Kelly, $4.66 million. Mario Cristobal, $2.5 million. Herm Edwards, $2 million. Jonathan Smith, $1.9 million. The SEC, Jimbo Fisher, $7.5 million. Dan Mullen, $6.1 million. Jeremy Pruitt, $3.8 million. Chad Morris, $3.5 million. Matt Luke, $3 million. And Joe Moorhead, $2.6 million. Thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, Chip Kelly, he's getting the $4.66 million. Was offered more by Florida, as far as I know, but saw UCLA as a better job. And then the other three, I mean, Mario Cristobal, nobody was interested in hiring for head coach, so they could get him for basically, you know, anything they wanted. Herm Edwards, another guy nobody was interested in hiring as a head coach. They got him for whatever they wanted. I guess his agent got him an extra, you know, $1 million more than he's probably worth. And then Jonathan Smith, you know, it's his first head coaching job, and he's getting like a big time Power Five job. It's not a great job, but it's a Power Five job as his first head coaching gig. So those all seem pretty fair to me. Jimbo Fisher is a proven national title winning head coach. 7.5 is insane. 10 years for $75 million is insane, especially when you factor in that it's guaranteed. Dan Mullen is a proven coach, having coached like 11 years at Mississippi State and turned that program into something that's actually credible. The Jeremy Pruitt hire, I'd love to get your wife's thoughts on this. I don't think it was a great hire. I think Alabama DCs and Alabama OCs, it's been really hit or miss. Obviously, Kirby Smart's been pretty good for Georgia, but I don't know about Jeremy Pruitt. And then, you know, the rest of these I think are fine. I think Matt Luke is probably a little overpaid at Ole Miss, but it's probably a, you know, that was probably a persuasion thing because Ole Miss is now under sanctions, so something to get him to stay on board. And then Joe Moorhead is a first-year guy at Mississippi State, so that makes sense. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think this just kind of shows you what, I mean, what we're going to see is like a bunch of new coaches in Pac-12 making significant, you know, you add them all up and they don't add up to two of the SEC coaches that are, you know. So it's, I think it's just going to be, if the gap keeps going like that, and, you know, projected all the things, the projections I see is it is going that way. Then you're talking about it's harder to keep coaches. It's not like a Willie Taggart thing where you're going to like a dream job and you get to go to Florida State. But if it's close, if it's not the dream job, but you're at a program of similar size, but they're willing to pay $2 million more a year for their head coach, then I think that's going to be a problem. And then you could have a brain drain as far as, you know, anytime you get a really good coach, you could just pluck them away from the Pac-12, and they're making that much less money. So I think that's what part of the problem is from the last question. I mean, these numbers don't surprise me, but I think because of that revenue gap, it's just going to be – I mean, it's just going to get worse and worse, and it's going to be harder for these teams, all the teams, to compete, and just in my opinion.
Yeah, but none of these – I mean, none of the Pac-12 teams are paying the max of what they could have paid. I mean – ASU is fresh off of, you know, Todd Graham getting well over $3 million a year, and they're paying Herm $2 million. These are all – they read to me they're discount hires. They got Jonathan Smith. He's an alum. They think it's going to work out. They just dealt with, you know, Gary Anderson quitting on them midseason, so they want a guy who's loyal to Oregon State. That makes sense. Herm Edwards is whatever, Ray Anderson's best buddy, so he gets the job at ASU. And Mario Cristobal's a coordinator who, you know, last had a job as a head coach, you know, 7 years ago. But I mean, Chip Kelly at 4.66, that's a hard line set by the UC Regents. That is, I think, 30% more than Jim Mora was going to make this year, which would have been, that's the hard cap from the UC Regents, before you have to get reapproved at the contract level. So I get what you're saying, but I don't know that these four hires are necessarily indicative of that revenue gap. I think it's more that three teams in the Pac-12 made discount hires this year, well below what they could have paid a head coach.
Well, I think Matt Luke, that's an interim, you know, that's a discount hire too. And he's getting more.
Yeah, but it's Ole Miss under sanctions. I mean, and I don't know, maybe there's a premium you have to pay to, you know, to get a head coach in the SEC, especially in the SEC West, where you're going to be in a really competitive division where you have to deal with Alabama constantly making the playoff, let alone winning their division. So, you know, I think there's some circumstantial differences for sure. And yeah, there's some revenue difference, no question, but I don't know that that's indicated by the amount they're paying their coaches necessarily, but maybe I'm wrong. I could 100% be, I just, you know, Chip Kelly took a healthy discount from what he was going to get paid at Florida. He was probably going to get that $6 million that Dan Mullen got to coach at UCLA. And, for some of these guys, I don't even know that it's necessarily the biggest of deals to get 7 versus 6 or 5 versus 4 or whatever it is. I think they're going to look for situations that work for them.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing is with it's going to limit the Pac-12 more, where you're going to have to find people that if this was a straight up bidding war and UCLA wanted Chip Kelly and Florida wanted him, like UCLA's not going to win it. You know, they're going to get he's going to get more money at Florida. But Chip Kelly's personality, he's more of a West Coast. I mean, it would just fit better on the West Coast. So you have to kind of find those. But if you get other ones where it's not a guy that needs to be in the Pac-12, he could go anywhere. And an Ole Miss is able to offer more than UCLA. And he goes to Ole Miss. Like, you don't want that happening. Like, you don't want that kind of stuff. And I think that's what it can lead to. But, you know.
Yeah, I look at, like, Jeremy Pruitt, Chad Morris, Matt Luke, and Joe Moorhead. Which of those four guys did Oregon State, Oregon, or ASU, would they have even wanted? I mean, yeah, maybe Chad Morris, maybe. But, like, Jeremy Pruitt wasn't going to be a candidate anywhere outside of the SEC because that was the main reason Tennessee hired him, is because he has SEC experience.
Yeah.
Matt Luke was the interim at Ole Miss that they promoted, but I don't think he was any kind of hot candidate. Joe Moorhead, perhaps, but Joe Moorhead's a guy without any West Coast experience or ties. So, I mean, there's some circumstantial, you know, stuff there. I just don't know that, you know, these guys are dudes who wouldn't have even been, like, considered for Pac-12 jobs. Now, Dan Mullen, maybe. And Dan Mullen, maybe at $6 million a year, that's not something a Pac-12 team is willing to pay for a guy who, you know, certainly turned around Mississippi State, but never turned it into anything great. But I don't know. I mean, I think at this, especially at this mid to lower tier level, like if Tennessee doesn't go after Jeremy Pruitt at 3.8, but Oregon decides to turn around and offer him 3, is he coming to Oregon? I mean, or is he waiting around for the next SEC opening?
No, I think he would probably come, but then the problem is that if he does well, then an SEC school offers him 4.5 next year, and then he's gone, you know?
And that's maybe the issue with ever, you know, really. And this is there is like a real legitimate like West Coast, like East Coast divide here, which I think should be, especially in context of the Taggart thing. When you hire a guy who's like Florida ties or SEC ties and you hire him out West and you're not, say, USC, or you know, maybe University of Washington, or maybe UCLA. I think you do have to be in fear of that. Like, especially a guy like Taggart, the first big Florida opening that comes up, he's going to be talked about it for it at least. And yeah, that has to be a consideration even when you're doing the hiring. I think it's just the Pac-12 is a different deal from, I mean, it's the one major conference that's this far, I mean, and significantly further away from the rest of them. So it does involve a little bit more, you know, fit, I think, when you're looking at who's going to be a head coach out here. And we're kind of getting away from the money now, but I think that has to play into the conversation. You know,
yeah,
the SEC schools have to be super competitive in salary compared to Big Ten, ACC, because they're all competing for the same pool of guys who recruit that whole area and all of that deal. The Pac-12 certainly is to an extent, but just not quite as much, because they don't, you know, the guys who have Pac, who have West Coast ties, they're only really going to the Pac-12, maybe a couple of Big Ten schools, maybe a couple of Big 12 schools like Oklahoma or, you know, Nebraska or Texas. Like, maybe those guys will end up with guys who have, you know, real West Coast ties. But for the most part, the West Coast guys stay in the West Coast. And I'm really interested to see what Oregon does with Mario Cristobal if and when, you know, Mark Richt retires at – so say Cristobal does really well there and Mark Richt retires at Miami. Is Cristobal leaving?
Yeah, I would think.
I mean, so I think you have to assess fit really, really, really well when you're hiring at the Pac-12.
Yeah. It's almost like one of us is, like, more fiscally conservative and one of us is more fiscally liberal and – well, the money doesn't matter all that much, money means a lot.
You can't stand that revenue gap. You cannot stand it under any circumstances.
No.
And I get it. I get it. All right, we got one last question. This is from our man, Zach. Hey, Ryan and Dave, let's get right to the questions this week. One, I get the frustration at Larry Scott, but as an objective consumer of college football, can't we admit that the Pac-12 didn't have a team on par with any of the playoff contenders? Did everyone get a memo that we're just going to ask, like, the same question in different ways a bunch of times? Is it really Larry Scott's fault that the Pac-12's very elite once-in-a-decade conference champion is a touchdown dog on a neutral field to a team that let Iowa hang 55 on them?
We kind of went over this.
Yes, we get your point. But Ryan's point is a good one, that if you know, if they'd done a little bit better scheduling, USC could have made it into the playoff. But yeah, I mean,
it's still been, you'd be a 7-point dog in the playoff against a similar team. And you're like, at least you have a chance to win the national championship at that point.
Right, right, right. And I think that's a fair point. It's just a question of whether, you know, and it gets into all that deserving question. Two, piggybacking on the first question, do you see the Pac-12 team having the pieces in place to make a legit run in the national title next season? And has there been recent teams that for whatever reason didn't make the playoff but would have been on the level with the top teams at the end of their respective seasons? SC last year and Stanford the year before come to mind. Next, it's so hard to project how things are going to look next year, because, all right, so UCLA just hired Chip Kelly. If this is Chip Kelly from Oregon, he's going to take whatever random spare parts UCLA has, and they're going to be really good next year. Now, is that going to happen? Who knows? I mean, and maybe it takes more than a year, but that could happen. USC could be really good next year if Sam Darnold stays, and if he doesn't, it might be, you know, a question mark. Washington should continue to be very good under Chris Peterson. Are they going to be good enough? Are they going to have you know, a top 8 quarterback in the Pac-12 next year versus a top 10? We just don't know.
Oregon could be really good next year.
They could be. They've got Justin Herbert back. They've got a lot of key pieces back. Their defense, hopefully, if Jim Leavitt leaves, still sustains some of what they did this year. But even if he stays, definitely will. But right now, I would say it's a firm maybe for me. I think it depends on what happens with Darnold. If he's back next year, I like USC's chances of repeating. Potentially in the Pac-12. I think, you know, Chip Kelly and UCLA are obviously a wild card. ASU, obviously, as we just talked about, has potential to be a 9-win team next year and be a spoiler, especially in the South. I don't know. Where do you stand on next year? Who do you think has a chance?
Is there a chance Rosen comes back, or is there not? Like, I've heard rumors that could potentially, or is that no?
I think it's a firm no.
Okay.
But maybe.
I mean, I think having your quarterback back, and it's hard to win the Pac-12 without that. So I would look, if a Darnold comes back, I think USC is talented enough that they'll be in the mix. I think Washington will certainly be in the mix. I mean Stanford again. You know, no Bryce Love, right? Or, KJ Castillo.
I think probably not Bryce Love.
Yeah, I would guess. But they're always in contention. You know, they don't have to go to Australia this year, I think. So I think that helps. I don't know about Washington State. They're just kind of disappointing me a little bit. But, you know, Oregon is like that fact that the team in the North that I think has that potential. If Willie Taggart was back for sure, but, you know, we'll see what happens there. And then ASU in the South is going to be interesting to watch. If Herm Edwards is just a CEO and the coordinator, so I thought did a good job this year, kind of build on that. If they can build on 6-3 in the Pac-12, I mean, that's pretty freaking good, you know. But we'll see. It's hard to project right now, but I think there'll be less roadblocks to knock the best teams off. You know, let the best teams like play each other and knock each other off on equal terms and not, you know, with one team off a bye and, you know, 6 days rest on the road, all that kind of crap.
Yeah. And then the teams that were playing Stanford in 2015 is always the one that comes to mind for me, because that was the team that lost to Northwestern at the beginning of the year in that really weird game. And if they hadn't lost that game, that offense was spectacular by the end of the year. They had that really fun game against Notre Dame. That's the team that I think they could have gone into the playoff and really wrecked some stuff. And they were just a little bit away, I think, in the rankings at the end of the year. But yeah, if they'd beaten Northwestern, I think they would have been a shoe-in for the playoff. And, you know, that could have been that's a big what-if team for me. I think SC, by the end of the year last year, especially against, obviously in the Rose Bowl against Penn State, that offense was just playing spectacular football. I don't know if they rose to the level of Stanford in 2015 for me, but I thought SC was really good at the end of the year last year.
Yeah, I would say Stanford 2015 for sure. Just that early out of conference. And that was like a 9 a.m. game or something, too. Like,
oh, it was so bad.
It's just another like, just self-inflicted wounds that you don't need to do. Like, and Alabama, Auburn's not doing that. Like, you didn't need to do that. And so that's the kind of stuff where, yeah, you should have won that game anyway, but it's hard to win all of these college football games. And if you put more, you stack the deck a little bit more and more against you, you're going to lose some games, and it could be a really costly game. And that, you know, I think that one certainly was. USC last year, they would have had to beat, if they beat Utah and then they won their last like 10 games after putting in Darnold, and Darnold was like 10-0 instead of 9-1 as a starter. And they could have easily won that game at the end anyway. I think it would have been a different story and the storylines there. But yeah, they were playing awesome at the end of the year.
Yeah.
That's it, I think, right?
There's one more question.
Oh, we do?
At the end. From Zach, what are your biggest concerns and what are you most optimistic about for the LA schools going into the offseason?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the same point. Okay. Let's see. Biggest concerns and most optimistic. I guess I'll go first. So for USC, I think it's just they can't have like silly juniors go pro again. They've had that happen pretty much every year, guys that aren't going to get drafted and shouldn't go pro, but they do. If it's a Juju Smith or Dory Jackson, like, yeah, that's fine. You know, Ronald Jones is going to go. Sam Darnold, no argument if he goes. But there's other guys that are like probably shouldn't be going, and if they go, I think that will kind of hurt them a little bit. But the main thing I think USC needs to do is kind of upgrade the coaching staff a little bit. Get rid of a couple guys in key spots. Bring in some other dudes. They hired one guy last year, and I thought it was a home run hire, Dylan McCullough out of Indiana. Get a guy that has no USC ties. Just go get whatever position it is. Just go find a good one in the country and go bring him. You know, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Don't hire someone that you know and all that kind of stuff. So I think if Clay Helton does that, they'll be okay. For Chip Kelly and UCLA, I mean, the biggest hurdle is done. You got Chip Kelly in, and now you got to let him do his thing. So I don't have a whole lot of concerns with UCLA. Like I'm like Dave, like don't worry about some guys decommitting and all that kind of stuff. If it takes him a year or two to get what he needs done. But you got the big fish. You got the main hire that everyone wanted. Now you just got to kind of let him do his thing.
Yeah. I think I'll say it for you. I think USC should be in the market for a new special teams coordinator. I think that'd be a good thing for them. I think that was a concern this year. I think it cost them some points. I did a little study on UCLA special. I did a little study on UCLA special teams, and they were also bad. I think LA, the LA schools in general, could do a little bit better on that key but forgotten often aspect of the football game. For UCLA, I think Ryan hit it on his head, Chip Kelly. So you just kind of let it play out at this point. I think if you want to have something to worry about in the offseason, I don't think, you know, when Jim Mora was hired at UCLA, he took over a lot of talent from Rick Neuheisel. And I think Chip Kelly takes over even a little bit more talent. But at a few key spots, UCLA's not very good. And I don't know if it's going to necessarily show up even under a new staff. Because, you know, some guys, you know, they'll suddenly come to life under a new staff. I think at linebacker, UCLA just kind of lacks really top-end talent. And on the offensive line, I think there are some smaller issues as well. That's, you know, getting into the weeds of it. I think even with those issues, I think it's going to be probably a pretty good season next year and then potentially, you know, a really, really good season in 2019. So that's, you know, I think both schools should be going pretty optimistically into the future at this point.
Yeah, I would think so. You know what's crazy? How the hell did we go over 2 hours again?
We're never going to go under 2 hours.
We had one game to preview.
One game to preview, and we talked for forever about. We talked to Chris Cartman. That feels like ages ago now.
Yeah, that was this show, right? We talked to him this show.
That was this very show. We did the All Pac-12. We argued about money for like 30 minutes, and now here we are. Here we are at the end.
So we know Dave doesn't like money. He's like, money doesn't matter.
I hate money, obviously.
Although, then you had this plea from the beginning that you're like, I moved out of L.A. because of money. And then you're
because I hate it. I hate it so much. And there's so much of it in L.A., and I just had to get away.
Oh, good stuff. But I thought it was a good show. Chris was great. He killed it. And hopefully that gives everyone a better perspective on Herm, the Herminator. he does know what the Sun Devils are. He now knows that the fork is up and not down. He knows about jerseys.
Big steps.
Yeah. You need to know about the jerseys. I wonder how many, those are things that were like, that they allowed to be like public. Like how many like behind the scenes kind of things have happened? Like someone made a comment like, hey Herm, they don't wear belts anymore and stuff like this stuff. like there's gotta be some things like, really? Like, that's how that works? You know, like, there's got to be some of those.
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't coached in the college game in, like, 30 years. I mean, how was that recruiting test for him? You know, the test they all have to take before they start recruiting? How was that?
So he must have passed it, right? Because he's already talking to guys.
I would assume so. I don't know if they've changed the rules on that thing. But
I think you have to pass it, yeah.
Yeah.
It might not have been a first time. I mean, it might take a little.
Yeah, it might have been like a driving test type deal where, yeah, you know, third time's the charm, whatever.
And I think some, like, the arguments I got with some dudes on Twitter where they're like, he's going to kill it in recruiting. I'm like, dude, these kids don't know who he is. And I think Chris is like kind of.
I heard bad reviews about him because he did the wasn't he at one of the All-American games? Like, he's a guy who, like, would go and, like, counselor. I heard some, like, bad off the record reviews of him. Like,
really? When he was running that?
He was just kind of awkward to deal with and like that whole thing. So I probably shouldn't even be like saying that unsourced, but like I didn't hear anything good from him from those All-American bowl practices that everyone keeps talking about as a reason why he's going to connect with the kids now.
You know, like Deion Sanders is one of the coaches down there, yeah, and like, yeah, it's fine. Like he's, you know, he's a legend. Like, I don't think the players care, but if it's like a former coach, there's probably some level of coaching expectation. And if the reviews are bad, that's probably that good. I mean, if you're like a 16-year-old kid and he walks into your door, you know, through the door, like mom and dad know he is. And if the problem's going to be like, oh yeah, I've seen you on a meme like that. If that's like, how you know
his memes, I had to go look him up again because I forgot, like, because there's so many of these things that happen, like these coaching tirades, and I remembered like vaguely the "you play to win the game" thing, but like, I mean, are moms and dads even really like remembering him that well? Like, if I asked my mom and dad who's Herm Edwards, they'd be like, huh, I don't know. And so, like, I don't know what their name recognition is there. I mean, I think among media types, there's certainly some, but, like, average family raising a kid playing football? I mean, how often is Herm Edwards entering your thoughts if you're in that position? And, yeah. and if you're a 16-year-old, you were 7 when he was last coaching. Like, you don't remember anything. You're not, oh, yeah, I studied the Jets or, like, the Chiefs when you were coaching there. I really liked what you did when you ran the ball 400-plus time with Larry Johnson. Like, nobody's going to be excited about that stat. And second, like, no, nobody was watching that. And nobody, like, connected it to you. And now he talks on TV. I mean, a lot of guys talk on TV. It doesn't make them good recruiters.
Yeah. And if they, like, you know, if they did
hire Steve Levy, he'd be a great recruiter. People know him.
If they did watch him on TV, they'd, you know, see that he had, like, what was it, 54-78 as, like, a head coach? Like, that was his overall record, something like that.
Dude was a bad coach. Bad. Not good, bad.
Now, some people argued with me on Twitter. He did make the playoff, like, 4 out of 8 years and stuff. And I was just like, yeah, and he was 2-4 or something in the playoffs. And I don't know.
He makes the playoffs in the NFL besides the Browns. Like, everybody does at some point.
Yeah, it's like kind of an every other year thing. Like, oh, you make the playoffs this year, and that's what it was.
Yeah, it's the league of parity. I mean, there's one team that you can guarantee is going to be in every year, and that's the Patriots. And there's one team that's going to be out of it every year, and that's the Browns. And everyone else is in the middle.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, he seems like, you know, a reasonably nice guy. Like, there's part of me that is rooting for him, even though I know I don't think there's a part of you that's rooting for him at all, I'm guessing. But part of me, like, that would be kind of interesting. Even though I predicted it would be a tremendous crash and burn, I wouldn't mind being wrong if, you know, for some reason he did some, like, great humanitarian stuff and it was this awesome story. Like, I wouldn't mind that. But my gut just tells me.
I'm not rooting against him. I'm just...
You are.
Well, now that I've actually staked my claim to a point here, right. Yeah, I'm definitely rooting against him because I want to be right. But I'm not rooting against him from, like, a, you know, like, I hope this guy who I don't know at all does poorly. It's more just, it's such a bad process hiring. Like, the things that bother me generally are, like, the bad processes. Like, if you end up with a bad result, but you have a good, like, so just strictly in football terms. If, like, bad things happen, like you lose a game by 3, but you manage the game really well, I'm going to be a lot more excited about that game than a game where you won by 2 touchdowns, but you should have won by 7. And you played so poorly, and there were so many issues, like the clock management was terrible. Like, I'm going to be more upset about that one because it's the process. And the process of hiring this guy was such a complete joke. And the process of rolling this guy out was such a complete joke that it's just... It's hard to be in support of it in any real way. And I think, you know, Cartman's board is a good example of this. I think there's a lot of people who, you know, in the fandom section are just going to be like, all right, well, he's the guy now, so we're going to, you know, support him blindly. And then there's a lot of people who are, I think, maybe a little bit more process-oriented, like I think you are and I am, where it's just like, yeah, but this guy, there's nothing speaking to this guy being good. Like, nothing at this point speaking to this guy being good, and maybe he will be, but this was a horrible process to get him hired.
Yeah, I agree with you there, and that's kind of the part of the problem with our boards, and I'm dealing with it at USC now. And it always happens is that you stake your claim. So we said, hey, Herm Edwards is going to crash and burn, biggest train wreck ever, it's going to be awful. And so you kind of have to root for that, right? But I think the problem with our message board sometimes is, so when Clay Helton was hired, there was dudes that are just like, this is the worst, because the process was bad. I mean, it was the same thing. Like, he's had pretty good results since he's been hired, but the process to hire him wasn't good. And these people stake the claim, and then they'll just go over the top and be like, they'll make these silly arguments to the point where it's like, yeah, I get that he shouldn't have been hired, but he did win the Pac-12 was 11-2. Like, you have to at least acknowledge that. Like, if there's some success, right. If Herm Edwards has some success, you're like, I think the way that the process was terrible, but... And maybe the whole team came in and the staff was the same and he didn't do a whole lot. And the you know, it was a young team that most people were coming back and all, you could argue all that stuff. But if he has great success, you're like, but they did go 10-2 this year or something, whatever it is.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. And we'll be talking about it on here because we're not here to root against Pac-12 teams.
No.
So, I mean, if it works out, yeah, I mean, we'll certainly be talking about it. But at this point, I don't think they've set themselves up for success. And maybe it works out. But, yeah, I think there were – basically what we're always saying on here, like in any of this stuff, is they could have improved their odds for success by making a better hire with a better process. Now, maybe it works out. Things can work out, but certainly I don't think Ray Anderson did a good job here.
No. Yeah, if you're in Vegas and you got 19 and you're drunk and there's like a hot chick next to you and you're like, double down, that's not a good process. That's not very smart. But a two could come.
If I work out, you could get that two. Who knows?
It's like it could. But, yeah. See, Vegas comes back to money. All right. Well, I guess we should.
Follow the money. You'll find it at the end of our podcast.
All right. Well, I guess we should wrap it up. David, good show.
It was great. It was wonderful. I laughed. I cried.
Yeah. Great. And, we're doing it this offseason, man. People might not believe us, but we're going to keep it going. All right. So we'll keep going through signing day. After signing day, we're still going to do shows. Okay. So just let people know.
Yeah. We'll figure out at a later date what those shows are going to involve, but we're going
to
do them.
Yeah. And get ready to send those questions in. Tell us all the, all the stuff of ranking the worst this and best that and all that kind of stuff. We'll take the whole offseason talking about all that stuff.
Hell yeah.
All right. Well, that's David Woods. I am Ryan Abraham, and you've been listening to the Podcast of Champions. If you're still listening, bless you. We give you kisses on both cheeks like they do in Europe. And thanks for tuning in, and we will talk to you next time.